2014 Yearbook of Jehovah's Witnesses. 2014 Year Text. Let Your Kingdom Come. Matthew 6:10. About 100 years ago, Jehovah installed Jesus as King in the invisible heavens. Since then, God's servants have zealously made known the blessings that Christ's kingdom will bring. Imagine, under the loving rulership of Jesus, the earth will become a paradise filled with people who truly love one another. There will be no crime, no fighting, no sickness, no suffering, and no death. Soon, those blessings will become a reality. God's kingdom is real, and it will come and fulfill all that Jehovah has purposed. Pray for the kingdom to come. Tell others about it, and treasure the hope of all that it will do for you.
A letter from the governing body. Dear fellow domestics, how delighted we are to write you at the beginning of this momentous year. By late 2014, a whole century will have passed since our beloved King, Jesus Christ, began ruling in the midst of his enemies. Early in this service year, at the annual meeting of the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of Pennsylvania, the New World Bible Translation Committee released the newly revised English edition of the finest translation of the Bible available to mankind. Jehovah used his own Spirit-begotten sons to provide the original New World Translation. That fact alone certainly makes this translation special. Do you not agree? For many years, the Writing Committee of the Governing Body has made Bible translation its priority. Today, the New World Translation is available in whole or in part in 121 languages. We entreat you to show Jehovah how deeply you appreciate the Bible you have. Read it and meditate on it every day. Thereby, you will draw closer to its author, Jehovah God. We're moved when we hear of the trials that our precious brothers and sisters are facing. Understandably, they may at times find it difficult to rejoice with their brothers. One family in Asia, for example, recently had their lives turned upside down when the mother suddenly became completely paralyzed. Baffled, the medical experts were unable to reverse her condition. How sad. The husband now provides around-the-clock care for his wife. Their son and two daughters are setting a good example as Christians by giving loving support to their parents. This fine family, as well as all of you who have successfully dealt with various trials, can feel the joy that comes from enduring tests of your faith. Jehovah assures his anointed ones and the other sheep that we will be happy that we kept on enduring trials, because we will be blessed with the gift of everlasting life. Last year, the memorial attendance was 19,241,252. How encouraging to see so many honor Jehovah and Jesus Christ by attending the most important meeting of the year for God's people. During the memorial season, a great shout of praise ascended as millions served as auxiliary pioneers in March and April. How inspiring! And were you not pleased to learn that those enrolled as auxiliary pioneers during the circuit overseer's visit may enjoy the entire pioneer meeting that he conducts, even if his visit is not during the months of March or April? Spiritually wise ones understand the value of keeping active in the preaching work and in congregation activity. Being busy helps us to remain steadfast and immovable, foiling the devil's attempts to undermine our faith and push us off course. How invigorating it is to note that during the past service year, 277,344 symbolized their dedication by water baptism and are now on the road to life along with their brothers worldwide. These new ones need our support to become stabilized in the faith. Colossians 2:7. Continue to encourage one another to endure to the end. Speak consolingly to those who are depressed. Support the weak. Be patient toward all. 1 Thessalonians 5:14. Finally, may each of us pray constantly, saying, "Let your kingdom come." 1 Thessalonians 5:17 and Matthew 6:10. Please enjoy this yearbook and know that we love each and every one of you lovers of Jehovah. Your brothers, Governing Body of Jehovah's Witnesses.
Highlights of the past year. Jehovah gave Ezekiel a vision of a colossal celestial chariot, which represents the invisible part of Jehovah's organization. Despite the chariot's immensity, it moves swiftly and changes direction with lightning speed. Exciting developments during the past year indicate that the earthly part of Jehovah God's organization is likewise on the move. An organization that is on the move. On Friday, July 5, 2013, the United States Bethel family was thrilled to hear Anthony Morris of the Governing Body announce, "On Thursday, July 4, 2013, an agreement was reached to sell the 6 buildings comprising the 117 Adams Street and 90 Sand Street complex in Brooklyn. The sale of buildings 1 to 5 requires that we vacate them by mid-August of this year." Brother Morris explained that the laundry and dry cleaning department, located on the 6th and 7th floors of Building 3, would continue to function there until mid-2014. The 90 Sand Street building, he said, will likely be vacated during the 2017 calendar year. The sale of the 6 large buildings is part of the effort to move the world headquarters of Jehovah's Witnesses from New York City to a 253-acre property at Warwick, New York. However, preparation and excavation at the construction site could not proceed until the necessary permits were obtained. Hence, the United States Bethel family listened eagerly to the announcement read by Mark Sanderson of the Governing Body on Thursday, July 18th, which said, "We are happy to announce that on Wednesday evening, July 17th, the Warwick Planning Board unanimously approved the site plan for the new world headquarters of Jehovah's Witnesses. This is the final approval needed to begin obtaining building permits to start construction. It is of interest to note that last evening's approval came exactly 4 years to the day since we closed on the purchase of the Warwick property. What is more, the events of the last few days that led to this approval provide dramatic evidence of Jehovah's blessing." Brother Sanderson thanked everyone for their tireless work and earnest prayers in behalf of this important project. "Most of all," he said, "we give praise and thanks to Jehovah for this important milestone in the relocation of the world headquarters to Warwick, New York." On Friday, July 26th, Brother Morris met with some 1,000 Bethel and Regional Building Committee, or RBC, volunteers who were gathered in the new dining room located at Tuxedo, New York, the staging area for the Warwick project. After speaking on an encouraging spiritual topic, he said that he had an announcement to make. "In my hand," said Brother Morris, "I have something I just received that I would like to share with you. At the top of this form, it says, 'Building Permit.'" Before he could read any further, the volunteers erupted in thunderous applause. To the delight of all in attendance, Brother Morris went on to read portions of the first major building permit, which had been issued by the town of Warwick just 3 hours earlier. What is happening at Wallkill, Warwick, and Tuxedo? Since the start of the expansion project at Wallkill in August 2009, about 2,800 brothers and sisters have served there as temporary volunteers. The project includes a new residence building, a parking garage, and an office building. One of the present residences is being renovated, and adjustments are being made to the printery, laundry, auditorium, services building, and main lobby. Construction on the Wallkill expansion is expected to continue until the end of 2015. In the meantime, construction began at the site of the future world headquarters at Warwick. In the few months since the work started, grading and excavation, as well as installation of underground utilities, have been underway. Construction of the first three buildings, the vehicle maintenance building, the visitor parking garage, and the maintenance building, began late in 2013. These buildings are critical in caring for the equipment and the on-site workforce, both during and after construction. They will be followed by the construction of residence buildings and the office services building, which are slated to begin in 2014. The Tuxedo facility, a 50-acre property located about 6 miles north of Warwick, is a support site for the future world headquarters at Warwick, explains Construction Project Committee member Kenneth Chernish. It will house some of the volunteer workers and will also be used to support them with meals, materials, and equipment. To expedite the construction project at the Tuxedo facility, selected RBCs in the eastern part of the United States have been assisting with certain aspects of the work. Many volunteers who work with RBCs around the country look forward to having a share in the construction of the future world headquarters. Skilled brothers and sisters are already making themselves available for temporary volunteer service on these construction sites. Leslie Blondo, who works in the plumbing department with her husband Peter, says, "Working together draws us closer to each other and gives us memories that we will cherish for a long time." "I am currently working with the electrical crew here at Tuxedo," says Mallory Rushmore. "Every day it is exciting to see all the people here, all the volunteers, everyone working together." "This is a remarkable privilege," says Quincy Dotson. "I thought that I would be giving a lot of myself, but in actuality, I've been gaining so much more." "It is thrilling to be a part of this project," says Brother Chernish. "The brothers and sisters are doing the job quickly and efficiently, and at the same time, they're enjoying it immensely." JW.org, A Witness to All the Nations. Jesus said, "This good news of the kingdom will be preached in all the inhabited earth for a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come." Matthew 24:14. The JW.org website is certainly proving to be a very effective tool in reaching all the nations in the short time remaining before the end comes. A missionary couple in the Solomon Islands were preaching in a seaside fishing village when they came across four elderly men. They saw that the men had mobile phones, so the missionaries asked them if they knew how to use the internet. They did. The couple then showed them how to access JW.org, how to find their own language, how to download the magazines and the Bible, and how to use the section for families and children. When these missionaries are out in the preaching work, they enjoy showing children the video, "Pray Anytime." After one group of excited children saw the video, they ran off into the tropical jungle, singing, "Anytime, Anywhere, I Can Pray." The following are but a few of the many letters of appreciation that have been received by our world headquarters in New York.
"My husband and I moved to Mexico, and we are trying to learn Spanish so that we can preach to everyone we meet. Every time I go to JW.org, I thank Jehovah because it has helped me to listen and to learn. There is so much available, magazines, books, music, and dramas in so many languages. I thank you and love you for all the hard work you do. DH, Mexico."
"I am legally blind, and I absolutely love your website because there are so many recordings I can listen to. I am writing to encourage you to continue to put more of your books, brochures, and other printed material into the MP3 format, audio files, because I can listen to them throughout my day. KG, United States."
"I love JW.org. It is user-friendly and has inspired me to be more zealous about personal study and my ministry. I am 72 years old, have been baptized for 47 years, and have pioneered for over 30 years. I am the mother of 9 baptized children and have 16 grandchildren and 3 great-grandchildren. We now have 4 generations of regular pioneers in our family. I thank Jehovah for this spiritual food at the proper time. M.T., United States.
I'm writing this letter at 4 a.m. I often spend nighttime hours awake because I suffer from multiple sclerosis and other afflictions, as do so many of our dear spiritual brothers and sisters throughout the world. Jehovah continues to look after us spiritually, and it is in connection with this that I would like to thank you. I tend to think in pictures, which is why the layout of the website is good for me personally. The graphs, video clips, and pictures, all tied in with pointed, clear comments, are very much appreciated. BB, New Zealand.
I am writing to say thank you. I work as a doctor in a remote part of Sri Lanka, where I do not receive the magazines in my language. But thanks to your website, I can download and read them in my own language. Your website is one of the best gifts that Jehovah has given to people like me. NF Sri Lanka.
I'm writing this letter to thank you for all the hard work that you do to help people learn about Jehovah. Please keep making videos for JW.org. Those videos have helped my family and me with problems. The video that helped me the most is Beat a Bully Without Using Your Fists. Once again, thank you for your hard work. YS, age 9, United States.
I want to thank you and Jehovah for the spiritual food that we have. The website JW.org has helped me very much, especially the teenager section. I also appreciate the series Become Jehovah's Friend. I have 3 small sisters, and I see what a positive influence this information has on them. Despite being far away from you, we are a united brotherhood because of the love that we all feel for Jehovah. Thank you. AB, Peru.
The following is supplementary information. JW.org, Facts and Figures. 316 languages in which the website is available. 220,000 plus number of web pages on the site. 600 languages in which downloadable publications are available. 130 requests for Bible studies per day from over 230 countries. 5 million plus videos viewed per month. 1.5 million downloads per day. 900,000 plus visits per day from over 230 countries. They appreciate Watchtower Online Library. On June 28, 2013, JW.org carried the announcement that Watchtower Online Library, or WOL, had recently reached the milestone of supporting 100 languages. WOL can be used with most devices that allow access to the Internet, such as a desktop or a laptop computer, a tablet, or a smartphone. Most of the dated library material is from the year 2000 forward. In many languages, the New World Translation and Insight on the Scriptures are also included. The search feature can be used to search for a word, a phrase, or a combination of words, as can be done with Watchtower Library. Using this online library, you can look up scriptures or information in one language and then synchronize the search with another language. Here are some expressions of appreciation for this invaluable research tool.
Thank you so much for WOL. When I saw this new study tool, I was overwhelmed with appreciation. I am not at all knowledgeable about computer programming or web design, yet I can tell that this research tool is of excellent quality. Your love of neighbor, love for your brothers, and love for Jehovah really shines through. The design of WOL is a display of your evident care. I could not have asked for a better gift and expression of love and generosity from my Heavenly Father, Jehovah. Thank you so much. A. Argentina.
I can't believe it. This afternoon, I went to WOL, and Haitian Creole was one of the new languages there. I never thought that this would happen. Obviously, from this letter, you can see that I am at a loss for words. May Jehovah bless all your efforts, and may His Holy Spirit keep guiding you. D.C., United States.
Animated videos touch righteous hearts. Caleb, the little boy in the JW.org video series Become Jehovah's Friend, is now known all over the world. The first video of this amiable little fellow has already been translated into over 130 languages, and hundreds of letters have been received about this video series. The following letter came from an 11-year-old and her 8-year-old sister. We would like to make a contribution to the worldwide preaching work. We earned this money by raising 2 beef calves and selling them. Their names were Big Red and Earl. We wanted to give you this money because we thought you could use it to make more Become Jehovah's Friend movies. We thought it would be cool if Caleb got a new baby sister and had to deal with all of the attention being taken away from him. The Caleb movie is our favorite movie. Many children have memorized the entire video, including the song and even the narrator's comments. One sister wrote that her congregation of 100 publishers has 40 children, most under the age of 10. She was sitting in the third row when song number 120 was sung at the conclusion of a meeting. It brought tears to her eyes to hear all the children singing their song so enthusiastically. A grandmother related that after her granddaughter watched the video twice, she announced, "I have to clean up my room so that nobody falls on my toys and gets hurt." She was so intent on her mission that she insisted on tidying up her room before she sat down to eat her meal. In a rural village in South Africa, scores of children were coming and going from a witness home every day. Some thought that it was because the family used to sell candy, but the village children had been invited by other children to see the animated video, Listen, Obey, and Be Blessed, in their language, Xhosa. 11 children were present at one time, and all had memorized the words of the song. In Ecuador, 2 non-witness Quechua-speaking boys, 8-year-old Isaac and his 5-year-old brother, Saul, used to save their daily snack money to buy toy guns, swords, and action figures. One day, their mother asked them to tidy up their room and to put all their toys in a cardboard box under the bed. Later, the boys were given the new Become Jehovah's Friend DVD as a gift, and they watched it together. A week later, while the mother was cleaning the house, she found that the cardboard box under the bed was empty except for a toy car. She asked the boys, "Where are the toys?" They answered, "Jehovah doesn't like those toys, so we threw them in the garbage." Now when other neighborhood children play with toys that promote violence, Isaac tells them, "Don't play with that. Jehovah doesn't like it." A fascinating tour through time. In October 2012, a new self-guided exhibit outlining the history of Jehovah's Witnesses opened in Brooklyn, New York. The exhibit highlights the struggles and dangers faced by those who sought to practice Christianity as taught by Jesus. In the first week alone, more than 4,200 guests and members of the Bethel family toured this exhibit. Naomi, a witness who lives nearby, took her tour soon after the exhibit opened. The timeline format helped me to understand when and why things happened as they did, she commented. I learned a lot about our organization and its modern-day history. The tour begins with the Christian era in 33 CE and continues to the present. The exhibit is arranged in 4 sections. Each section has a scriptural theme and is introduced by a short video that can be played in English with subtitles in 7 languages. The first section, Men Have Loved the Darkness, draws its title from the words of Jesus found at John 3:19. The Bible foretold that after the apostles died, wicked men would rise and speak twisted things. Acts 20:30. Those who dared to resist the tide paid a heavy price. In stark contrast, the next section, Let the Light Shine, based on 2 Corinthians 4:6, picks up the timeline in the late 1800s when sincere Bible students began a fresh study of the Scriptures. They abandoned long-held beliefs that are not in the Bible and courageously preached illuminating truths. This section tells of their growth in knowledge and numbers before World War I. The tour continues with a room that highlights an accomplishment that intrigues Jehovah's Witnesses to this day. In 1914, the Bible students, as Jehovah's Witnesses were then known, began presenting the photodrama of creation. Millions saw this multimedia production, which combines still and motion pictures with recorded sound. Exhibited items include some of the original artwork, a short sampling of the program's introduction, and over 500 color slides. Satanic persecution of Christ's followers, described at Revelation 12:17, is the theme of the third section, designated The Dragon Grew Wrathful. Christian neutrality during times of war is highlighted here. Augmenting the displays of artifacts and pictures, short video clips dramatize the attempted coercion used on conscientious objectors, such as Remigio Cuminetti of Italy, who refused to wear a military uniform or fight in World War I. Another clip tells of Alois Moser from Austria. He refused to say Heil Hitler, and as a result, lost his job and was eventually sent to the Dachau concentration camp. A reconstruction of a dimly lit jail cell provides a sobering backdrop for pictures that document the imprisonment of Jehovah's Witnesses for practicing their faith in Greece, Japan, Poland, the former Yugoslavia, and elsewhere. The final section, Good News for All Nations, based on Revelation 14:6, looks at the activity of Jehovah's Witnesses in recent decades. Their rapid growth, persistent preaching, and brotherly love are reflected in pictures that line the walls. Finally, a bank of interactive kiosks allows visitors to explore the Bible House and the Brooklyn Tabernacle, places used by Jehovah's Witnesses over 100 years ago. The exhibit is located at 25 Columbia Heights in Brooklyn, New York. It is open Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., and admission is free. If you are in New York City, why not come and take a fascinating tour through time? Legal Report. The Apostle Paul urged Christians, "Keep in mind those in prison as though you were imprisoned with them." Hebrews 13:3. As Jehovah's servants, we keep remembering our faithful brothers and sisters and pray concerning all those who are in high positions, so that we may go on leading a calm and quiet life with complete godly devotion and seriousness. 1 Timothy 2:1 and 2, footnote. The following are some of the legal issues that Jehovah's Witnesses have been dealing with during the past year. Our brothers in Russia continue without let-up teaching and declaring the good news, despite an ongoing campaign by the Russian Orthodox Church and some government officials to stop our activity. Acts 5:42. Russian authorities persist in misapplying, to our publications and to our brothers individually, a vague law on extremism that they originally framed to counteract terrorism. As a result, Russian courts have declared that about 70 of our publications contain extremist expressions, and government officials have added these publications to a national list of banned extremist literature. On the basis of this alleged danger, some local authorities raid kingdom halls and the homes of our brothers in order to find the publications. Police detain, photograph, and fingerprint many witnesses for engaging in the ministry. They often attempt to intimidate our brothers while holding them at the police station. Beginning May 2013, 16 brothers and sisters in the city of Taganrog stood trial for organizing, attending, and participating in Christian meetings and engaging in the preaching work. This is the first time since the fall of the Soviet Union that witnesses are facing criminal charges for practicing their faith. Authorities elsewhere in Russia are trying to get the courts to declare our literature extremist and to charge our brothers as criminals guilty of religious hatred. Conditions for our brothers and sisters in Eritrea have not improved. As of July 2013, there were 52 in prison, including 8 brothers who are at least 70 years of age, as well as 6 sisters. 3 brothers, Paulos Iasu, Isaac Mogos, and Negede Teklamariam, have been in prison since September 24, 1994, for their neutral stand on military service. Over half of those imprisoned are in the Mitre prison camp, located in the desert north of the capital, Asmara. From October 2011 to August 2012, the authorities punished 25 of our brothers by putting them in a corrugated metal building half buried in the ground. In the summer months, the guards let the prisoners out during the day to escape the building's intense heat. However, they receive inadequate food and insufficient water, so the brothers' health suffers greatly. Sadly, Johannes Heila, a 68-year-old brother, died in August 2012 because of this mistreatment, as did brother Miskina Gebretinsai in 2011. Conscientious objection to non-neutral service. Based on Isaiah 2:4 and John 18:36. Armenia. The European Court of Human Rights, or ECHR, rendered a favorable judgment on November 27, 2012, in the case of Khachatryan and others versus Armenia. The government had brought unlawful criminal proceedings against 17 witnesses for refusing to perform alternative civilian service under the control of the military. Armenia has paid compensation as well as legal expenses to the victims of this unlawful action. Despite the favorable ruling in Khachatryan and the earlier landmark judgment in Bayatyan versus Armenia, as well as subsequent ECHR judgments, the Armenian government continued to prosecute and convict young witness conscientious objectors. However, on June 8, 2013, the government passed amendments to the Alternative Service Law that seemed to eliminate military control and supervision of alternative service. All imprisoned witness conscientious objectors were released by November 12, 2013, and young witness men who apply for alternative service are having their applications granted. South Korea. As of October 31, 2013, there were 602 brothers in prison. Since 1950, authorities in South Korea have sentenced 17,605 of Jehovah's Witnesses to a total of 34,184 years in prison for conscientiously refusing to perform military service. Until recently, many imprisoned witnesses shared prison cells with criminals, even serious offenders. However, a delegation of brothers called on the chief of the Korea Correctional Service to ask prison administrators to separate our brothers from other prisoners. Prison authorities acted promptly and separated the majority of our brothers from criminals so that by April 2013, at least 75% of the imprisoned brothers were 4 or 5 brothers to a cell. What impact has this change had on our brothers? We are away from such negative influences as immorality and abusive speech, said one brother. Another said, now we have an interchange of encouragement and can hold all 5 meetings each week. In the meantime, 56 men who were discharged from military service into the reserve forces and who later became witnesses are being repeatedly prosecuted, fined, and detained for objecting to military training call-ups. Since they receive several call-ups a year for up to 8 years, the ongoing injustice is particularly difficult to deal with. Singapore. Despite repeated requests to perform alternative civilian service, 12 brothers are being held in the Armed Forces Detention Barracks, each serving a 39-month prison sentence. Another brother is serving a year in prison for declining reserve military duty. Turkmenistan. 9 male witnesses imprisoned as conscientious objectors are serving prison sentences of 18 months to 2 years, and often face merciless beatings by prison guards and soldiers. When these witnesses are released, the authorities often prosecute them again as repeat offenders and place them on a stricter prison regimen. Advocates for 10 witnesses who have refused to do military service have filed complaints with the United Nations Human Rights Committee. Conscientious objection to patriotic ceremonies. Based on Daniel 3:16-18. Tanzania. The Court of Appeal at Dar es Salaam, Tanzania's highest court, unanimously found impermissible the actions of a school board that expelled 5 students and suspended another 122 for refusing to sing the national anthem. In a decision published July 12, 2013, the court recognized the genuineness of the faith of the witness students and their constitutional right to have their freedom of conscience and religion protected. The determination of these young ones to remain loyal to God resulted in a victory that upholds Jehovah's name and our freedom of worship in Tanzania. Freedom of expression. Based on Acts 4:19-20. Kazakhstan. An expert study conducted by the Regional Department of Religious Affairs declared a number of our publications extremist, alleging that they incite social and religious discord. On April 6, 2013, police in the city of Karabalik seized literature during an unauthorized raid of a congregation meeting held in a private home. On July 3, 2013, the Astana Economic Court upheld a decision to ban 10 of our publications, thus continuing to censor and restrict the importation of our literature. Further, in December 2012, state officials commenced a series of arrests and convicted our brothers for so-called illegal missionary activity. On March 28, 2013, the Agency for Religious Affairs directed the Regional Religious Center of Jehovah's Witnesses to inform Jehovah's Witnesses in Kazakhstan that it is illegal to preach outside their registered places of worship. As of July 2013, authorities have initiated cases against 21 of our brothers and sisters. Freedom of assembly and association. Based on Hebrews 10:24-25. Azerbaijan. In January 2010, the State Committee for Work with Religious Associations refused to re-register the Religious Community of Jehovah's Witnesses because of alleged technical flaws in the application. Despite numerous attempts by Jehovah's Witnesses to rectify the alleged deficiencies, the authorities continue to refuse re-registration. On July 31, 2012, our brothers brought this case to the attention of the ECHR, claiming that the government violated our freedom of religion when, without legal basis, it refused to grant re-registration as a religious association. Without re-registration, our brothers do not have the benefits of full legal status. Liberty and security of person and property. Based on Philippians 1:7. Ukraine. Although the witnesses enjoy freedom of worship in Ukraine, physical assaults, arson, and acts of vandalism on kingdom halls have been perpetrated against them. Law enforcement agencies do not effectively investigate and prosecute these incidents. It is not surprising that this gives opposers a sense of impunity. Hence, our brothers have experienced an increase in criminal acts against them in 2012 and 2013. The 5 reported incidents of vandalism and arson in 2010 grew to 15 in 2011, 50 in 2012, and through the first 5 months of 2013, there were 23 incidents. The branch office is taking these injustices to the United Nations Human Rights Committee. Right to Self-Determination. Based on Acts 5:29 and Acts 15:28 and 29. Argentina. In the spring of 2012, Pablo Abarracini, an innocent bystander during an attempted robbery, suffered multiple gunshot wounds and was unconscious when he was rushed to the hospital. He had previously signed a durable power of attorney in which he refused treatment that involves the use of blood products. Although the hospital was willing to respect his clear decision, a non-witness family member attempted to obtain a court order to transfuse Brother Albarracini, arguing that a blood transfusion was necessary to save his life. However, Argentina's Supreme Court ruled in favor of Brother Albarracini, respecting his right to direct his medical care even while he was in an unconscious state. He did not receive a blood transfusion and recovered fully from his ordeal. He was grateful that Jehovah helped him to keep his integrity on this important issue. Victims of religious discrimination. Based on Luke 21:12 through 17. Kyrgyzstan. On April 16, 2013, a court made a favorable ruling in behalf of our brothers in Taktogul, where a kingdom hall was destroyed twice by local residents. The court convicted the perpetrators and ordered them to pay compensation. Prosecution of those chiefly responsible for the first attack is underway, giving hope that problems in that area will end. In the meantime, the congregations will rebuild the Kingdom Hall. Outstanding legal victories. 1. The issue. Must a religious group obtain permission to hold conventions and congregation meetings? The decision. On December 5, 2012, the Constitutional Court of the Russian Federation affirmed that the Russian Constitution guarantees freedom of religion and ruled that our brothers may hold religious meetings without giving prior notice or getting permission from the authorities. 2. The issue. Do citizens have the right to privacy of personal medical records? Background. In 2007, a deputy city prosecutor in St. Petersburg, Russia, ordered all medical institutions in the city to forward every refusal of blood transfusions by Jehovah's Witnesses to the prosecutor's office, but without notifying the patient. When Russian courts failed to uphold the patient's right to privacy, the brothers made application to the European Court of Human Rights, or ECHR. The decision. On June 6, 2013, the ECHR ruled that the prosecutor's order violated fundamental privacy rights and confirmed that there existed no relevant or sufficient reasons for disclosing private information to public officials. The decision was final as of October 7th, when the Grand Chamber of the ECHR rejected Russia's request for referral. Avilkina and others versus Russia. Updating previous yearbook legal reports. The government of France has complied with the settlement ordered by the ECHR on July 5, 2012, in a case of unjust taxation. The government has repaid the previously confiscated money with interest, as well as legal expenses, and has removed all liens on the branch property. 2013 Yearbook, page 34. Jehovah's Witnesses in India continue to experience opposition in different parts of the country. However, they have not been detained or had to face false charges as in the past. Currently, there are about 20 pending cases of litigation to redress the wrongs committed against our brothers. 2013 Yearbook, page 35. Dispatches. News from around the world. The police helped to unload the blocks. In Kutaisi, the second largest city in the Republic of Georgia, assemblies were held for 13 years in a dilapidated old champagne factory. Plastic sheets were hung above the seats to keep rainwater from pouring onto the audience. Now the brothers have a suitable, new, open-air, expandable kingdom hall for assemblies and conventions. During construction, 50 volunteers were unloading cement blocks from a truck when policemen came by to see what was happening. Impressed by the joy and diligence of the workers, the policemen commended them and then helped unload the blocks. They invited the brothers to call them if anyone bothered them. The policemen promised to attend the first convention held at the new assembly hall. He sold his bicycle. Malachi, an elder who lives in Burundi, earned his living by farming and by transporting loads on his bicycle. In order to support their Kingdom Hall construction project, Malachi decided to be at the construction site every day. To do so, he needed money to care for his family during the 2 months of construction. So he sold his bicycle and gave part of the money to his wife for his family's needs, and he put the rest of the money in the contribution box to help with the construction costs. As a result of his efforts, he received good training from the Kingdom Hall construction servants. After the Kingdom Hall was completed, Malachi was able to find construction work because people saw what a skilled builder he was. In the meantime, Malachi has been able to buy himself another bicycle. They were motivated to help. Building Kingdom Halls in remote areas of Malawi presents unique challenges. During the past service year, one hall was built in an area where the roads are particularly bad. Using vehicles with four-wheel drive, brothers from the branch delivered construction materials to the building site. The local brothers said that people in the community were very interested in the project. Many non-witnesses in the area offered to help and worked late into the night unloading sand, quarry stone, bags of cement, and iron roofing sheets. In fact, there were times when the non-witnesses outnumbered the witnesses. Impressed with the effort that Jehovah's Witnesses are making to build dignified places of worship in remote areas like theirs, the local residents felt motivated to help. The children sold toffee. A special pioneer couple in Côte d'Ivoire studies the Bible in Bété, the local language, with a couple who have 10 children. In May 2013, the first assembly in Bété was to be held in the town of Daloa, and all in the family wanted to attend. However, the cost of transportation was 800 CFA, or $1.60 US per person round trip, and the father could not afford to take his large family. Determined to attend, he came up with an idea. He gave 300 CFA, or $0.60 US, to his oldest daughter and suggested that she sell toffee. So she did. She made enough profit to pay for her trip. The father did the same with the other children. He gave each one 300 CFA to start a little toffee business until they all had enough to pay for their transportation. Finally, along with some others, they attended the assembly. How thrilled they were to follow the program in their mother tongue. Branch dedications. On October 20, 2012, Jehovah's Witnesses in Korea rejoiced when their renovated and newly built branch facilities were dedicated to Jehovah. The event was especially meaningful because the brothers were able to look back on 100 years of faithful service. Moreover, in 2012, the number of publishers exceeded 100,000 for the first time. Some 1,200 local volunteers and 239 international servants and volunteers from 9 countries worked to construct a new residence building, a printery building, audio-video studios, and a vehicle repair garage. In addition, most of the existing buildings were completely renovated. Anthony Morris, a member of the governing body, presented an encouraging dedication talk to the 3,037 brothers and sisters in attendance. The next day, a special meeting was held in a large exhibition hall, and over 1,300 congregations in Korea were tied in through the Internet. A total of 115,782 Jehovah's Witnesses and interested ones enjoyed the delightful spiritual program. March 9, 2013 will long be remembered as a milestone in the history of Jehovah's worshipers in Liberia. Visitors from 11 countries assembled for the dedication of the newly renovated and expanded branch office. All were thrilled to hear the dedication talk delivered by Guy Pierce, a member of the governing body. After more than a decade of civil conflict had delayed the planning and construction, the branch was expanded to include adjoining property that had formerly been used by rebels as a hideout and refugee camp. The 51 members of the Bethel family rejoiced to use the 35-room residence, renovated office building, new shipping warehouse, new maintenance building, and new kitchen and dining room. The Republic of Georgia is home to warm, spiritually inclined people. After the breakup of the Soviet Union, an extraordinary period of theocratic growth ensued, followed by a period of severe persecution. The opposition has largely subsided, and a major milestone in the history of Jehovah's Witnesses in Georgia was reached on Saturday, April 6, 2013, when David Splane of the governing body delivered the dedication talk for a renovated and enlarged branch complex, an assembly hall, and a new Bible school facility for the School for Kingdom Evangelizers, as well as the School for Traveling Overseers and their wives. A total of 338 guests from 24 countries joined more than 800 Georgian witnesses for the dedication program. The following day, 15,200 enjoyed Brother Splane's special talk by audio-video tie-in to congregation meeting places throughout Georgia. This international event was very moving for many. One young brother said, "Now I know what the new world will be like." On June 29, 2013, a new three-story office building at the Bethel facilities in Yangon, Myanmar was dedicated. Guy Pierce of the governing body gave the dedication talk to an audience of 1,013 that included guests from 11 other countries. The group of Myanmar brothers and sisters assigned to welcome these guests at the Yangon International Airport were approached by a man from a country where the work of Jehovah's Witnesses is banned. He pointed to the "Welcome Jehovah's Witnesses" signs that they were holding and asked, "Are you welcoming witnesses for some kind of court case?" "No, we are welcoming our friends," they replied. "So who is this Jehovah?" the man asked. Needless to say, the brothers and sisters gave him a fine witness. The day after the dedication program, a special meeting was held at the Myanmar Convention Center, where Brother Pierce spoke on the subject, "Serve Jehovah with an Understanding Heart." The program was tied in by telephone to 6 other locations throughout Myanmar, enabling a total of 2,963 to hear the timely information. One of the bus drivers who drove a group of local brothers and sisters to the special meeting in Yangon remarked, "I notice that you people are entirely different from other religions. You are well-behaved, well-dressed, and very kind. I have been driving bus groups for many years, but never have I seen such decent people." Jehovah's loyal servants in Moldova had good reason to rejoice on Wednesday, July 3, 2013, when Stephen Lett of the governing body gave the dedication talk for the newly expanded branch facilities. The expansion includes a 3-story building with a literature depot and 10 residence rooms, as well as a 2-story kingdom hall, which is being used by 7 congregations. The 33 members of the Moldova Bethel family were happy to welcome visitors from Germany, Ireland, Netherlands, Romania, Russia, Ukraine, and the United States. Also in attendance were a number of brothers and sisters who served Jehovah faithfully while the work was under ban, some of whom helped to copy and distribute literature during that time. Among the attendees were many who had been deported with their parents to Siberia during the various campaigns against Jehovah's Witnesses in the former Soviet Union. On Sunday, Brother Lett gave a stirring talk that was interpreted into Romanian and Russian for an audience of 14,705, the largest gathering of Jehovah's Witnesses ever held in Moldova. Keep on praying and do not give up. Jesus emphasized that we should pray and not give up. When you express yourself in prayer, you fortify your hope. Hence, pray constantly. Yes, persevere in prayer. 1 Thessalonians 5:17 and Romans 12:12. As you do so, may the God of peace equip you with every good thing to do His will, working in you through Jesus Christ what is well-pleasing in His sight. Hebrews 13:20 and 21.
Preaching and Teaching Earthwide. Lands, 239. Publishers, 7,965,954. Total hours spent in the field ministry, 1,841,180,235. Bible studies, 9,254,963. Africa. Lands, 58. Population, 979,685,702. Publishers, 1,363,384. Bible studies, 3,265,314. I am now ready to leave Babylon the Great. Thompson, a young man who lives in Uganda, had become dissatisfied with religion. Appalled by the clergy's emphasis on money, he stopped attending all religious services. Yet he continued to read his Bible daily. He was particularly intrigued by the book of Revelation and tried to interpret it, making notes in a small book. When a brother met Thompson at his place of work, a small construction site, he found him reading his Bible. An animated discussion ensued, and Thompson accepted the book, What Does the Bible Really Teach? He read it from cover to cover in one night. The next day, the brother received a text message that said, Thank the Lord for the information you gave me. I am now ready to leave Babylon the Great. Thompson asked for all the publications referred to in the footnotes and appendixes of the book. He immersed himself in his Bible study, made rapid progress, and was baptized at the 2012 Safeguard Your Heart District Convention. In March 2013, Thompson began serving as a regular pioneer, helping others see the need to leave Babylon the Great. 8 brothers studied with him. Jimmy grew up in Port Louis, the capital of Mauritius. He started drinking at the age of 16, and soon began getting drunk every day. Under the influence of alcohol, he often lost all self-control and was sent to prison several times. Sometimes he drank up to 3 bottles of rum and smoked 60 cigarettes in one day. If he ran out of money, he would drink alcohol used for cleaning windows. He even drank his mother's eau de cologne. When someone told him that he looked like a living corpse, he checked himself into a detoxification center. He stayed there for 1.5 years, but it really did not help him. Eventually, Jimmy met Jehovah's Witnesses and accepted a Bible study. Occasionally, he would leave the study to get a drink. Over time, 8 brothers studied with him. Jimmy eventually realized that he had to change his way of life. He said, "I felt as though the spiritual sword of Hebrews 4:12 were piercing my heart. One day, while reading my Bible, I saw Proverbs 24:16, which says, 'The righteous one may fall 7 times, and he will get up again.' That was the turning point in my life. After falling with 7 brothers who studied with him, Jimmy was determined to change and to get up with the help of the 8th brother. Jimmy implored Jehovah for strength, attended congregation meetings, and got rid of his bad habits. He was baptized in 2003 and became a regular pioneer in 2012. He now serves as a ministerial servant in a congregation on the island of Rodriguez. Jehovah and the angels will be my friends. 70-year-old Mary in Kenya had been a member of the Presbyterian Church all her life. She was a prolific fundraiser and had helped build one of the local churches. When one of her sons became a witness, she was not happy. He would invite her to the congregation meetings, but Mary refused to attend, saying that she wanted to hear the Bible's message in her own language, Kikuyu, and not in Swahili. Finally, Mary accepted an invitation to attend a district convention that was going to be held in the Kikuyu language. At the convention, she sat in the section for the elderly. She was greatly impressed by the kind and loving way in which she was treated. Mary said that she had never experienced such love in her church. She listened attentively to all the talks and was happy with what she heard. When she was offered a Bible study using the Listen to God brochure, she immediately accepted. After studying for a few months, Mary decided that she wanted to be one of Jehovah's Witnesses, so she resigned from her church. The church leaders were furious. They called a pastor from the capital, Nairobi, to come and talk to her. The pastor tried to persuade Mary not to leave the church, but she stood firm. "Who will be your friends if you leave the church?" he asked. "You have many friends and neighbors who are members of the church." "Jehovah and the angels will be my friends," answered Mary, "and the witnesses will be my friends too." Having failed to dissuade Mary, the pastor left. Mary continues to make good progress in her Bible study and is attending all Christian meetings, even though she lives far from where they are held. Recently, when she was not able to take public transportation to the meeting, she walked for 2 hours in the rain to attend. In spite of opposition from neighbors, Mary is determined to reach her goal of baptism. The pastor tripped her. A 14-year-old girl named Ashton lives in Cameroon. When she started to study the Bible with Jehovah's Witnesses, she met stiff opposition from her aunt and uncle with whom she lives. They insisted that she attend religious services with them at the Pentecostal church. During one of the services, the pastor laid her hands on the heads of those in attendance, transmitting the Spirit, causing them to fall down. Ashton did not fall. The pastor prayed and prayed, but Ashton remained standing. So the pastor tripped her to make her fall. Upon returning home, Ashton told her aunt and uncle that she had been tripped, but they did not believe her. She decided right then and there that she would never again go to church. Today, despite the opposition and the insults from her family and neighbors, Ashton continues to attend meetings at the Kingdom Hall. An invitation from a toddler. Although Anilpa was only 17 months old, she had a zealous share in the campaign to invite others to attend last year's district convention in Angola. Anilpa's assignment was to knock on the doors and wait to hand invitations to the householders while her mother briefly explained the reason for their visit. Full of enthusiasm, Anilpa was not always willing to wait for her mother to finish before starting to knock on the next door. She made a very good impression on the householders. For example, on the last day of the convention, a woman approached little Anilpa and said, "I was looking for you. I am so happy I found you, since you were the one who invited me to attend the convention. Tired of being oppressed. In August 2012, publishers from the Antavirinambo congregation in Madagascar met a group of people who said that they wanted to become Jehovah's Witnesses. The people felt oppressed by their church leaders, who taught one thing and practiced another. The church members said that their churches had no programs to teach them about the Bible and no publications to explain their beliefs. Church fees were high, there was no real brotherhood, and there was no evidence of true Christian love. They also said that they knew that Jehovah's Witnesses were not experiencing those problems. Later, the group wrote to the branch office. The letter said, "We are writing to let you know about our desire to serve Jehovah. However, we live far away. For some of us, it is a 9 to 15 hour walk to get to the meetings. So we beg you, please send somebody to help us study the Bible. We cannot fulfill our desire to serve Jehovah with our whole heart unless you give us some help to strengthen our love for Him. There are 215 of us from at least 3 different villages. We belonged to different religions, but now we all yearn to serve and obey Jehovah with our whole heart. We trust that you will help us." The brothers went to meet this group of people, walking 9 hours to the first village. There, the brothers held a meeting, and 65 interested ones attended. Word quickly spread, and people from other villages expressed their desire to be visited and to be taught the Bible. So the brothers walked another 4 hours to a second village and held a meeting that more than 80 people attended. There they met others who begged them to come to their village, which was a 2-hour walk away. The brothers willingly complied and held a meeting there too. Over 50 people attended. On 2 different occasions, over 30 of these villagers came to the assembly in Mahanuru, walking for a day and a half each way. 25 of them, couples, entire families, and elderly ones, came for the visit of the circuit overseer. They all stayed in one house, sharing their thoughts and asking questions late into the night. The villagers said that many more wanted to join the witnesses in their worship, because people were tired of being oppressed by their religious leaders. The Americas. Lands. 57. Population. 970,234,987. Publishers. 3,943,337. Bible studies. 4,341,698. They invited a couple to stay in their home. In Las Vegas, Nevada, a non-witness couple wanted a peaceful place to live, so they sold their home in order to move to the Dominican Republic. However, they had to leave their house 10 days before their flight was scheduled. To help them, their neighbors, who were Jehovah's Witnesses, invited the couple to stay with them in their home. During their stay, the couple attended a meeting at the Kingdom Hall. They were surprised and found it interesting to hear the date 1914 mentioned. They knew that this was a key date in world history. Once the couple arrived in the Dominican Republic, they requested a Bible study from the first witnesses who called on them. 14 months later, they were both dedicated and baptized. Just what she needed. The brothers set up a literature stand at the 2012 International Book Fair in Panama City, Panama. 2 schoolgirls approached the stand. One of the girls told the sister who was tending the stand that she was upset. The girl explained that her father was a drug addict and that she did not know how to deal with the situation. The sister showed the girl chapter 23 of the book Questions Young People Ask, Answers That Work, Volume 2, entitled, "What If My Parent Is Addicted to Drugs or Alcohol?" The girl exclaimed, "This is just what I need!" The girls hugged the sister and returned an hour later to thank her again. During the 5 days that the fair lasted, the brothers placed 1,046 books, 1,116 magazines, and 449 brochures. 56 people left their addresses so that the witnesses could visit them. 4 years of preaching on his own. Freddie, whose mother tongue is Quebecar, lives in a remote mountain community in Costa Rica. Some 4 years ago, while working in the capital, San Jose, Freddie obtained the book, What Does the Bible Really Teach?, and the brochure, What Does God Require of Us? The publisher who placed the literature with Freddie told him to go and preach to his people, so he returned to his community. Freddie studied the Bible Teach book on his own and made changes in his life, such as legalizing his marriage. Then he taught the Quebecar people the truth as best he could. Freddie arranged classes for his Bible students. He had 6 levels of classes, assigning students according to how well they did on an exam that he gave them to test their Bible knowledge. He organized meetings and even held the memorial, writing up his own invitations, which stated, "Jehovah's Witnesses invite you to attend the memorial of Christ's death with us." He did all of this for 4 years without any further contact with the witnesses. Meanwhile, he prayed to Jehovah to send witnesses to help him. Recently, Freddie's prayer was answered. Some witnesses made the difficult trip to his community and were amazed to see all that he had accomplished. They reported, "Although Freddie is not a baptized witness, he lives like one." After just 3 months, he was approved as an unbaptized publisher. In order to get baptized, Freddie came down the mountain to attend his first convention, bringing along 19 of his Bible students. Now he has organized 3 additional Quebecar speaking groups in settlements even more isolated than his own. She defended her faith at school. One day, Anna, who attends high school in the United States, had to defend her faith against several of her peers who were outraged that she did not believe in the Trinity. "They started to gang up on me," reports Anna, "but I kept calm because I did not want to give onlookers a bad opinion of Jehovah's Witnesses." That night, she prayed to Jehovah for courage and did research on the Trinity doctrine. The next day, Anna brought her Bible to school. Her classmates surrounded her, many of them snickering. Nevertheless, she courageously shared several scriptures and reasoned on them. Eventually, those arguing with her became speechless. The primary antagonist, who was also the class president, ended up confessing that she now respects Jehovah's Witnesses. Throughout the school year, she asked Anna various questions about her beliefs. A broken shoe at the right time. A young woman in Barbados was walking to church one Sunday morning when a strap on her shoe broke. She went to a nearby house and asked for a safety pin to fix the shoe. It happened to be the home of a witness sister and her daughter. While the young woman was repairing her shoe, the sister explained to her how Bible prophecies are now being fulfilled. The sister's daughter then invited the young woman to attend the meeting with them at the Kingdom Hall later that morning. Seeing that she was late for her church service, the woman decided to accept the invitation. During the meeting, she looked up all the scriptures in her King James Bible. The program deeply impressed her. She said that she was tired of hearing the noise of drums and shouting in her church, and that she had always wanted to study her Bible in a quiet atmosphere. She accepted the Bible Teach book as well as a Bible study. She attends all the meetings and eagerly participates in them. Only one person can stop him from preaching. A young brother in Guyana relates, "I like to witness to my classmates at school, but there is one boy who does not like it when I preach. One day, he pushed me against a wall and said to me, 'Stop preaching!' I replied that the only person who can stop me is Jehovah. As I continued preaching, the boy cut my backpack. He then punched me in the face, splitting my lip. Both of us were called to the office of the head teacher, who asked me what I had done to cause the boy to punch me in the face. I replied that I was preaching the good news, and that is why the boy was fighting with me. The head teacher asked why I did not fight back, even suggesting that I should have done so. I said that I had learned from the Bible at Romans 12:17 that Christians should return evil for evil to no one. On hearing that, the head teacher excused me and said that she would deal with the boy who attacked me. Asia and the Middle East. Lands, 47. Population, 4,282,178,221. Publishers, 674,011. Bible studies, 672,318. Help for a man who is blind, deaf, and mute. In 1999, the Sign Language Congregation in Kobe, Japan, learned of a deaf man named Hirofumi. When a brother tried to call on Hirofumi, his mother refused to let the brother see him. The brother called repeatedly and pleaded with the mother, and eventually she brought Hirofumi to the door. His hair and his beard were long and unkempt. He looked like someone who had been stranded on a deserted island for decades. His face was expressionless. Not only was Hirofumi deaf, but he was also blind. The brother was stunned, but then took Hirofumi's hands and began to do tactile signing. There was no response of any kind. Hirofumi had been isolated from people and had not communicated with anyone since he lost his eyesight 10 years earlier at the age of 31. The brother returned 2 days later. Hirofumi's mother was amazed, having assumed that the brother would give up after seeing her son's condition. Again, the brother pleaded with the mother to allow him to see Hirofumi, so the mother brought him to the door. After a month of visits and still no response from Hirofumi, the mother told the brother not to bother to come anymore. Nevertheless, the brother persisted. He took cakes to the home and did what he could to show that he cared. After 2 more months and still no response from Hirofumi, the brother felt that he was getting nowhere. The brother decided to make one last visit. Before going to the house, he prayed to Jehovah for help to determine if he should keep calling on Hirofumi. When the brother arrived at the house, he took Hirofumi's hands and signed that there is a God named Jehovah who was constantly watching him from heaven and who understood his sufferings more than anyone else. Jehovah cared about him and wanted to deliver him from distress. That was why one of his witnesses had come to him. At first, Hirofumi showed no reaction, but then he gave the brother's hand a firm handshake, and a tear trickled down his cheek. Moved by this, the brother shed tears with him. A Bible study was started. After studying 11 years, Hirofumi began to associate with the local congregation instead of traveling the long distance to the sign language congregation as he had been doing. No one in the local congregation knew how to sign, but over the next 18 months, 22 brothers and sisters in the congregation learned to sign so that they could help Hirofumi. In January of 2012, Hirofumi handled his first assignment on the Theocratic Ministry School, with someone interpreting his signs. In October of the same year, he became an unbaptized publisher. He studies with security guards. Florin, a pioneer who lives in the Philippines, conducts an average of 25 Bible studies, most of which are with security guards. These men often work evenings, some through the entire night. Consequently, Florin has to be flexible. He goes to the guards' workplaces and studies with them when they have a break or at other appropriate times that do not interfere with their work. He conducts some studies between 7 o'clock and 11 o'clock at night, others between 5 o'clock and 9 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes he arranges to arrive when shifts are about to change. In this way, He can study with the guard who is about to go on duty, and then study with the guard who has just finished his duty. Florin says, "By having so many Bible studies, I have experienced a joy that I had never known before." Some of the security guards now attend meetings at the Kingdom Hall. One of Florin's Bible students is now baptized and serves as a regular pioneer. They were willing to take the risk. While in the ministry one rainy day in Armenia, two of our sisters saw a mother and daughter on the street and offered them a tract. To the sister's surprise, the mother, whose name is Marusia, said that she and her daughter Yeva had been outside in the bad weather for 2 hours, hoping to meet Jehovah's Witnesses. Why? While in prison, Marusia's brother had learned the truth from brothers who were there because of their neutral stand. Marusia expected him to come out of prison a hardened and aggressive individual. Instead, he had become more balanced and calm. As he continued to associate with the witnesses, Marusia's brother made further changes for the better. All of this did not make sense to Marusia and her daughter, because they had repeatedly seen defamatory propaganda about Jehovah's Witnesses on posters in the city and on television programs. Yeva wondered, "My uncle is such a wonderful person. So why are there so many bad things being said about Jehovah's Witnesses?" Determined to settle the question, she said to her mother, "We'll never find out about these people unless we're willing to take a risk. Let's go find Jehovah's Witnesses right now and put an end to our confusion." And that is what they were doing the day the sisters met them. 2 days later, a Bible study was started with both mother and daughter. They began to attend meetings and have progressed to the point of becoming unbaptized publishers. The children brought the magazines. In Adana, Turkey, a woman who had experienced serious personal and family problems and who had even contemplated suicide found two of our magazines in front of her door. Apparently, some children in the neighborhood had found them on the ground and placed them there, believing that they belonged to her. The woman was greatly impressed by the life stories in the magazines, and she wished that her life could be transformed in a similar way. The woman called a telephone number that was written on one of the magazines and contacted a pioneer sister who lived close by. A Bible study was started. The woman appreciated what she learned and expressed her desire to attend meetings. As it turned out, her apartment was located near the Kingdom Hall. She started attending meetings immediately and continues to do so. 10 days in jail did not change his mind. Baum, who was a policeman and a churchgoer in Nepal, met a special pioneer couple on the street while he was on duty. He was impressed that they answered all his questions by opening the Bible. Baum accepted a Bible study, and soon he began to attend meetings. As his study progressed, his conscience began to bother him about his work, so he asked his superiors for an office job, which would not require him to carry weapons. The superiors agreed. However, after attending a district convention, Baum again began to struggle with his conscience and decided to leave the police force altogether. Baum's wife was not happy with this decision, since a job with the police force meant not only an appealing social standing, but also good wages, benefits, and a good pension. To persuade him to change his mind, she suggested, "If you stay on the police force, I will study the Bible with the witnesses." When that did not work, she convinced the police captain to put Baum in jail, hoping that he might see things her way. After spending 10 days in jail, Baum was released, but he was still determined to find a different job. He took up work as a bicycle rickshaw driver, which meant working long hours in the hot sun. Despite the challenges, he was happy. He continued to make spiritual progress and became a publisher. In time, his wife's opposition subsided. Because of the kindness shown to her by the brothers and sisters in the congregation, she started to study. Baum continues to provide for his family, earning more as a rickshaw driver than he did as a policeman. He was baptized at an assembly in February 2013, and now his wife and son attend meetings with him. She wanted to be an auxiliary pioneer. Myung-hee, a sister living in Korea, has a problem with one of her legs because of a paralysis that she suffered when she was 2 years old. She becomes easily exhausted and at times falls down. In addition, she endures frequent panic attacks and side effects caused by her medication. It is difficult for Myung-hee to breathe, and the tension and anxiety she feels cause her pain. Despite these problems, Myung-hee wanted to auxiliary pioneer and has done so nearly every month for the past 2 years. She thanks Jehovah for providing her with strength to carry out her ministry. I have been looking for it for 30 years. Agnes, a missionary in Indonesia, used to witness to a middle-aged woman who was expecting a baby. The woman sold vegetables in a local market. She loved reading our magazines and enjoyed having Bible discussions when she was not too busy. One day, when Agnes went to the market to visit the woman, she was not there. Her husband told Agnes that his wife had just given birth. Agnes decided to visit her. She brought the book, My Book of Bible Stories, wrapped as a gift. The woman was pleasantly surprised that Agnes had come to see her and the baby, but she was even more surprised when Agnes handed her the gift. The woman unwrapped the book, looked at it with disbelief, and said, "Where did you find this book? I have been looking for it for 30 years. I visited all the bookshops and asked everyone. Nobody had it, nobody knew about it, and no other book even came close to it." It turns out that when the woman was a child, her uncle had the Bible Stories book, and she loved reading it. Now the woman is again reading the book, and her eldest daughter loves reading it too. A Bible study was started with both of them. Europe. Lands, 47. Population, 741,892,871. Publishers, 1,601,915. Bible studies, 862,555. Have you come to the wrong place? A Somali woman in Sweden was invited to a meeting at the Kingdom Hall, and she decided to go. Things did not turn out well. No one welcomed her. Everyone there just stared at her. She felt very awkward. Someone who probably noticed that she looked uncomfortable asked her, "Have you come to the wrong place?" "Yes, I actually think so," she replied. Then she left. When the woman later met up with the witnesses who had invited her, she was upset and told them that she would never go back again. They wondered what could have happened, as they did not remember seeing her at the Kingdom Hall. After a little further discussion, they all realized that by mistake she had gone to a church. The witnesses encouraged her to try coming to the Kingdom Hall again. She agreed to go, but she said that she would stay no longer than 10 minutes if she felt uncomfortable. However, when she entered the Kingdom Hall, everyone in the congregation warmly welcomed her. She enjoyed being there so much that she was the last one to leave the Kingdom Hall after the meeting. Ever since, she has regularly attended the meetings, and she is now a baptized publisher. He found an invitation on the street. Stereos is a young man who lives in Greece. One morning, as he was walking home from work, he decided to walk down a different street rather than to take his usual route. Stereos saw something lying on the street that caught his eye. It was an invitation to the memorial of Christ's death. It featured the question, "How do you view Jesus?" Since there were people around him, Stereos hesitated to pick up the invitation from off the ground. When he arrived home, he started thinking about the printed question and was curious to learn more. Stereos had planned to have coffee with some friends that afternoon. On his way to meet them, he decided to go by the street where he had spotted the invitation, hoping that it would still be there. It was, but people were still around, so he again hesitated to pick it up. On his way home after having coffee with his friends, Stereos headed straight for the same street. The invitation was still lying there. This time, he picked up the invitation and read it. After doing so, he decided to attend the memorial. At the end of the memorial observance, Stereos accepted the invitation to have a free home Bible study. He started attending meetings and made good spiritual progress. He was baptized at a special assembly day in March 2013. A radio talk show broke down prejudice. In January 2010, Finn, a brother in Copenhagen, Denmark, went out for a walk and took some magazines with him. As he walked along a narrow street, he saw an elderly gentleman coming toward him. Finn offered him the December 2009 issues, which included several articles related to Christmas. When the elderly gentleman spoke, Finn recognized the man's voice. He was a highly educated radio talk show host. The next day, Finn listened to the program and was very surprised to hear the host explain that he had accepted the magazines the day before. He then read portions of the articles over the air. Among other things, he read about the mysterious star that appeared in connection with the birth of Jesus. He admitted that it must indeed have been sent by Satan. Encouraged by this response to the magazines, Finn decided to call on the talk show host. In the course of the conversation that followed, Finn politely asked if it was possible to put a program on the radio about Bible subjects. 2 weeks later, he received a positive reply. More than 30 two-hour programs followed, all about Jehovah's Witnesses and the Bible. The talk show host and Finn discussed chosen themes and answered hundreds of calls from listeners. One listener called the radio station's technician and left his telephone number. He wanted to be contacted by the brothers. This was readily arranged. The man had heard slander about Jehovah's Witnesses from friends and family for years. But because of the radio programs, his prejudice against the Witnesses had vanished. A Bible study was started, and in 2013, the man attended the memorial and the special talk. He attends all the Sunday meetings and makes meaningful comments at the Watchtower study. Other people in the area have likewise responded favorably to the truth because of what they heard on these radio programs. She left an invitation at their door. It was the last day of a district convention in Italy. As Lucio was saying goodbye to some friends, a couple approached the group. Lucio asked the couple which congregation they attended. "We're not from a congregation," they replied. "Did someone invite you?" asked Lucio. "No, we came on our own," they replied. Now Lucio was curious, so he asked, "Do you mind my asking what made you come?" They said, "We found an invitation at our door, and we decided to come." When they told Lucio where they lived, Esther, his wife, exclaimed, "I left that invitation. It was the last day of the campaign, and I thought that rather than to throw away the unused invitations, it would be better to leave them at the doors where no one was at home." Having found the invitation, the couple decided to travel to the assembly hall to attend the program the following Sunday. After a brief chat, Lucio and Esther invited the couple to their home for a meal, and they continued the conversation. The newly interested couple agreed to have a Bible study. They are always well prepared for their study and now attend and participate in the meetings. Oceania. Lands, 29. Population, 39,508,267. Publishers, 96,088. Bible studies, 63,333. Now I understand. Frida, who is deaf, was overjoyed when she learned that she and the sister who conducts her Bible study would be joining the first sign language congregation in Papua New Guinea. The congregation was formed on March 1, 2013. Frida realized that her comprehension during the meetings was greatly improved when she put the publications aside and focused her attention on the signing and visual aids on the platform. This way, to her own surprise, she overcame her shyness about participating and began to comment several times during the meetings. In April 2013, she qualified to become an unbaptized publisher and is having success in encouraging other deaf people to come with her to the meetings. When asked why tears often run down her face during the meetings, she replied, "Because now I understand." She got into the wrong car. While driving to the field service group in Australia, Barbara pulled her car to the curb to check to see if she had brought her return visit book. Suddenly, the car door opened and a woman started to get in. "Excuse me," said Barbara, "but I don't think you have the right car." "I'm sorry," the woman replied. "I thought you were the woman who was picking me up." Seeing Barbara's Watchtower and Awake magazines, the woman said, "I used to get these magazines years ago from two ladies who taught me the Bible." Barbara happily gave the woman the magazines and later started a Bible study with her. Letters from God. Violet is an 82-year-old infirm sister in Christchurch, New Zealand. She regularly sends letters and Bible literature to nursing homes and hospices in her area. The home care nurses who deliver the letters said that the elderly residents eagerly await what they call their letters from God. Some read and swap their letters and literature with others, or read them aloud to those with poor eyesight. The home care nurses also said that the residents who read the letters and literature are calmer, more positive, and more peaceable than those who do not. Regarding her witnessing efforts, Violet says, "I feel that Jehovah is still using me to help others. Sharing the truth in this way is truly uplifting." She read about roses. "I've already read that." This unexpected response took Bernie by surprise one Saturday morning when she was offering the latest copy of the Watchtower on the island of Saipan. She wondered how Bernadette, a college student who answered the door, had already read the magazine. Bernie reached into her bag and pulled out a different magazine. "I've read that one too," Bernadette said. Puzzled, Bernie asked, "Where did you read these magazines? Are you one of Jehovah's Witnesses visiting here on vacation?" Bernadette explained that she was not a witness, but she had read the magazines online. One day, while looking for information about flowers on the internet, Bernadette typed the word roses and was intrigued by one of the search results. "Alluring Roses from Africa," an Awake article featured on the website of Jehovah's Witnesses. Bernadette told Bernie that she had enjoyed the article about roses so much that she decided to explore the website further. First, she concentrated on information about plants and animals, but soon discovered fascinating things about the Bible. Sensing Bernadette's interest, Bernie offered her a free home Bible study and returned later with the book, What Does the Bible Really Teach? By Bernie's third visit, she and Bernadette were discussing chapter 1 of the book. About a year later, in November 2012, Bernadette was baptized. She made such rapid progress that her friends like to say that Bernadette ran into the truth. The website certainly gave her a fast start.
Sierra Leone and Guinea. About 500 years ago, near the mouth of the Sierra Leone River, a tiny silk cotton tree took root and sprouted. For 300 years, the tree grew tall as a tragic procession passed before it. Ruthless slave traders shipped nearly 150,000 men, women, and children overseas to foreign slave markets. On March 11, 1792, Hundreds of freed American slaves gathered under the cotton tree to celebrate their repatriation to Africa. That day, they founded a settlement that embodied their fondest hope, Freetown. Freed slaves continued to arrive until the settlement included over 100 different African groups. These new citizens adopted the cotton tree as a symbol of freedom and hope. For nearly 100 years, Jehovah's Witnesses in Sierra Leone have been comforting their neighbors with the hope of a far grander freedom, the glorious freedom of the children of God, Romans 8:21. This freedom will mean liberation from slavery to sin and death when God's messianic kingdom brings peace and paradise conditions to the earth. Over the past 50 years, the Sierra Leone branch office of Jehovah's Witnesses has also supervised the preaching work in Guinea. This neighboring nation has experienced political, social, and economic upheavals, prompting many of its citizens to welcome the Bible's heartwarming message. Jehovah's Witnesses in Sierra Leone and Guinea have proclaimed the good news in the face of countless obstacles. These include physical hardships, deep poverty, widespread illiteracy, ingrained traditions, ethnic divisions, and appalling violence. The account that follows testifies to the unswerving faith and devotion of these loyal servants of Jehovah. We trust that their story will touch your heart and strengthen your faith in the God who gives hope. Romans 15:13. An overview of Sierra Leone and Guinea. Land. Both countries feature coastal swamps, savannas, cultivated plateaus, and lofty inland mountains. Guinea is the source of three of West Africa's major rivers, the Gambia, the Niger, and the Senegal. People. The Mende and the Timni are the largest of Sierra Leone's 18 indigenous tribes. The Creole, descendants of freed African slaves, live mainly around Freetown. Guinea has over 30 ethnic groups, the largest of which are the Fulani, the Mandingo, and the Susu. The footnote reads, "Some tribes are known by multiple names." End of footnote. Religion. About 60% of Sierra Leoneans are Muslim. The rest mostly claim to be Christian. Nearly 90% of the people in Guinea are Muslim. Most people in both countries also practice traditional African religions. Language. Each ethnic group has its own language. The lingua franca of Sierra Leone is Creole, a blend of English, European, and African languages. The official language of Guinea is French. Roughly 60% of the people in each country are illiterate. Livelihood. Most people are subsistence farmers. Alluvial diamonds account for nearly half of Sierra Leone's export earnings. Guinea has one of the world's largest bauxite reserves. Food. A popular expression is, "If I haven't had my rice, I haven't eaten today." Fufu, boiled cassava pounded into sticky dough, is often eaten with meat, okra, and sour sauce. Climate. Hot and humid on the coast, cooler in the highlands. During the dry season, the Harmattan, a parching Saharan wind, blows for days, dropping temperatures and blanketing the region in dust. Land, square miles. Sierra Leone, 27,699. Guinea, 94,926. Population, Sierra Leone, 6,092,000. Guinea, 11,745,000. Publishers in 2013. Sierra Leone, 2,039. Guinea, 748. Ratio, one publisher to Sierra Leone, 2,988. Guinea, 15,702. Memorial attendance in 2013. Sierra Leone, 8,297. Guinea, 3,609. 1915 to 1947. Early days. the light of truth begins to shine. The good news reached Sierra Leone in 1915 when local residents returned from England, bringing with them Bible-based literature. Around July of that year, the first baptized servant of Jehovah arrived in Freetown. His name was Alfred Joseph. He was 31 years old and a native of Guyana, South America. He had been baptized earlier that year in Barbados, West Indies, and had taken a work contract in Freetown as a locomotive engineer. Alfred settled into the railway compound in Kleintown, located about 2 miles away from Freetown's cotton tree. He immediately began sharing the Bible's message with his workmates. The following year, Alfred was joined by a former workmate from Barbados, Leonard Blackman, whose mother, Elvira Hewitt, had introduced Alfred to the truth. Leonard became Alfred's next-door neighbor, and they met together regularly to discuss the Bible. They also distributed Bible literature to friends and other interested people. Alfred and Leonard discovered that Freetown's fields were white for harvesting. John 4:35. In 1923, Alfred wrote to the world headquarters in New York, stating, "Many people here are interested in the Bible. Can you send someone to look after them and to help develop the preaching work in Sierra Leone?" He received the reply, "Someone will be sent." Late one Saturday night, several months later, I received an unexpected phone call, Alfred relates. "Are you the person who wrote to the Watchtower Society asking for preachers?" a voice asked. "Yes," I replied. "Well, they've sent me," boomed the voice. The voice belonged to William R. Brown. He and his wife Antonia and their young daughter had arrived that day and were staying at the Gainford Hotel. The very next morning, Leonard and I were holding our weekly Bible study when an imposing figure appeared in the doorway. It was William R. Brown. He was so zealous for the truth that he wanted to give a public lecture the very next day. We promptly booked the largest hall in Freetown, Wilberforce Memorial Hall, and scheduled the first of 4 public lectures for the following Thursday evening. Our little group got busy advertising the lectures by newspaper, handbills, and word of mouth. We wondered how the local people would respond, but we had no need to worry. About 500 people packed into the hall, including many of Freetown's clergy. We were overjoyed. During the hour-long talk, Brother Brown quoted extensively from the scriptures and used lantern slides to project Bible texts on a screen. Meanwhile, he repeatedly declared, "Not Brown says, but the Bible says." The audience was amazed, and they applauded point after point. It was not Brother Brown's commanding oratory that impressed them, but his powerful scriptural proofs. As a young ecclesiastical student in the audience declared, "Mr. Brown knows his Bible." Brother Brown's lectures roused the city, and people flocked to hear them. The following Sunday, another capacity audience heard the discourse, "To Hell and Back, Who Were There?" The powerful truths Brother Brown presented that night prompted even prominent churchgoers to resign from their churches. The fourth and final lecture in the series, "Millions Now Living Will Never Die," drew such a large crowd that one Freetown resident later recalled, "The churches had to cancel their evening services because all their members were attending Brother Brown's lecture." Because Brother Brown always used the Bible, pointing to it as the final authority, people began calling him Bible Brown. The nickname stuck and became well known throughout West Africa. And until he finished his earthly course, William R. Brown wore that name with pride. Taking on the gladiators. When Freetown's clergy saw their flocks enjoying Brother Brown's lectures, they became filled with jealousy and rage. The December 15, 1923 issue of the Watchtower reported, The clergy have taken up the cudgel and are attacking the truth through the press. Brother Brown answered them time and again, the papers publishing both sides. Finally, the clergy fell silent. Their false reasoning had been clearly exposed. Bible truths had been spread far and wide, prompting many newspaper readers to request Bible literature. The clergy had schemed to silence God's people, but Jehovah had made their wicked deeds come back upon them. Rising to the clergy's defense, a church youth group, dubbed the Gladiators, announced a series of public meetings to put down Russellism, as they had styled the kingdom message. In response, Brother Brown publicly challenged them to a series of debates. The Gladiators refused to accept Brother Brown's challenge and rebuked the newspaper editor who printed it. They also barred Brother Brown from attending their meetings, so Alfred Joseph attended instead. The meetings were held at Buxton Memorial Chapel, a prestigious Methodist church in Freetown. During the question and answer session, recalls Alfred, I questioned the Anglican Creed, the Trinity Doctrine, and several other unscriptural teachings. Finally, the chairman refused to take any more questions. One of the gladiators present that night, Melbourne Garber, had earlier attended Bible Brown's lectures. He was, in fact, the young ecclesiastical student who said, Mr. Brown knows his Bible. After carefully weighing what he had heard, Garber was convinced that he had found the truth. Accordingly, he asked Brother Brown for a Bible study. Brother Brown invited him to the weekly watchtower study at his home. Even though his family disowned him, Garber made rapid spiritual progress, and he and several others were soon baptized. Satan's efforts to quash the preaching work in its infancy had failed. As the mayor of Freetown had told the gladiators, if this is the work of men, it will come to an end, but if it is from God, you will not be able to stop it. Brown's religion. In early May of 1923, Brother Brown cabled the London branch office for more literature. Soon, 5,000 books arrived, and this was followed by other shipments. He also continued to hold public meetings, and these attracted thousands of interested people. Later that year, the Watchtower reported, the work in Sierra Leone has increased so rapidly that Brother Brown called for an assistant, and Claude Brown, of Winnipeg, formerly of the West Indies, is now on his way to join in the work. Claude Brown was a tried and tested minister of the Good News. During World War I, he had endured ill treatment in Canadian and English prisons for refusing to violate his Christian neutrality. He served in Sierra Leone for 4 years, greatly strengthening the local brothers and sisters. Pauline Cole recalled, before I was baptized in 1925, Brother Claude questioned me carefully. Sister Cole, do you understand what you have learned from the studies in the scriptures? He asked. We do not want you to drift away from the truth because you did not understand the Bible's teachings. Brother Claude, I replied, I have read and reread what I have learned. I have made my decision. Pauline served Jehovah for more than 60 years, much of that time as a special pioneer. She completed her earthly course in 1988. William Bible Brown was also conscious of helping others cultivate good spiritual habits. Alfred Joseph relates, when I met Brother Brown early in the day, our conversation would go something like this. Hello, Brother Joe. How are you this morning? What's the Bible text for today? If I couldn't answer, he would impress on me the need to know each day's text from the book Daily Manna, now called Examining the Scriptures Daily. The next morning, I would read the text right away, so he would not catch me off guard. At first, I did not fully appreciate the invaluable training I was getting, but later on I did. All this training bore fine fruit. During 1923, a congregation was established in Freetown, and 14 people were baptized. One of the new brothers was George Brown, who brought the number of Brown families in the congregation to 3. The zealous activity of those 3 families moved many Freetown residents to label the Bible students Brown's religion. To the provinces and beyond. Fired with enthusiasm for the truth, the Freetown congregation became intensely occupied with the Word. Acts 18:5. Alfred Joseph relates, "I often tied a carton of Bible books to my big Norton motorcycle. Then, with Brother Thomas or Sylvester Grant riding pillion as a passenger, we headed out into the rurals and small towns around Freetown to canvass, as we called it." Up until 1927, the publishers preached mostly in and around Freetown in an area called the Colony. But starting in 1928, every year before the rain set in, the congregation would rent a bus and travel to the provinces. Those who could not go helped to finance the trips, which were led by Melbourne Garber. The bus groups preached in towns and villages east to Kailahun and south to nearly the Liberia border. The first Sunday of each month, they returned to cultivate the interest found. About that time, Brother Brown visited the West Indies and returned with a car, one of the first to enter Sierra Leone. The vehicle was equipped with a powerful sound system that was designed for public witnessing. Brother Brown would park the car in a public area and play stirring music to attract a crowd. He would then deliver a short talk or play a recorded lecture and invite the crowd to obtain Bible literature. The speaking car, as it came to be called, was a public sensation, and people flocked to listen to it. Brother Brown next turned his attention to spiritually untouched territory, the rest of English-speaking West Africa. During the late 1920s, he embarked on a series of preaching tours to the Gambia, Ghana, Liberia, and Nigeria. Brother Brown found interest in each country, but Nigeria seemed to be exceptionally fertile. In 1930, he and his family moved from Freetown to Lagos. From there, he continued to oversee the kingdom work in West Africa. In 1950, when poor health forced Brother Brown to return to Jamaica, he left behind a remarkable legacy. Over 27 years, he and his wife had seen the number of witnesses in West Africa grow from 2 to more than 11,000. They had literally witnessed the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy, "The little one will become 1,000, and the small one a mighty nation." Isaiah 60:22. Today, just over 60 years later, a mighty nation of more than 500,000 witnesses serve Jehovah in West Africa. Steadfast under ban. When World War II cast its shadow over Africa, Jehovah's people in Sierra Leone took their stand as Christian neutrals. The British authorities falsely branded them as subversive, so they monitored their activities and banned their literature. Customs officials in Freetown seized one literature shipment and burned it. Some brothers were arrested for possessing banned literature, but were soon released. The footnote reads, "The ban was lifted in 1948. End of footnote. Despite the ban, the witnesses kept on preaching. Pauline Cole explained, "A brother who was a steward on a ship that visited regularly continued to supply us with copies of the Watchtower. From these, we typed up extra copies for the meetings. We also printed leaflets on Bible topics and distributed them to the public. And the brothers continued to give public discourses and to play recordings of Brother Rutherford's radio lectures, especially in the outer villages." Those efforts, while modest, clearly had Jehovah's blessing. James Jarrett, a longtime elder and special pioneer, recalls, "During the war, I was working as a stonecutter when an elderly sister gave me the booklet, Refugees. Since many refugees were landing in Freetown, its title intrigued me. I read the booklet that night and immediately recognized the truth. The next morning, I tracked the sister down and obtained copies for my three brothers. All four of us accepted the truth. When the war ended in 1945, the Freetown congregation had 32 publishers. The publishers had kept their integrity and remained spiritually active. They were ready and eager to move ahead. Public Meeting Campaign. On August 29, 1945, at the weekly service meeting, the Freetown congregation discussed a new campaign announced in the December 1944 Informant, now called Our Kingdom Ministry. Each congregation was to advertise and hold a series of four public meetings in every city, town, and hamlet in its territory. Each meeting would feature a one-hour talk by a brother, aged 18 or older, who had done well in the Theocratic Ministry School. After the four meetings, the brothers would arrange Bible study groups to assist interested people in each area. How did the publishers react to this new direction? The minutes of the Freetown congregation's service meeting record the following comments. Chairman, how do you think we could go about this new campaign? Brother 1, we should not expect the same success as in America. People here are different. Brother 2, I agree. Brother 3, why not give it a try? Brother 4, but there will be difficulties. Brother 5, yet we must follow the direction given by Jehovah's organization. Brother 6, but the odds in this country are against us. Sister 1, nevertheless, the informant's direction is clear. Let's try it. So they did. From the coast of Freetown to Bow in the southeast to Kabbalah on the northern plateau, the brothers held meetings in schoolrooms, marketplaces, and private homes. This activity energized the congregation, and the word of Jehovah went on growing and spreading. Acts 12:24. Still, the publishers needed theocratic training, and that is what Jehovah provided. You will be dead within a year. Zacchaeus Martin, born 1880, baptized 1942. Profile: started pioneering when he was 72 years old.
Zacchaeus never had anyone study the Bible with him, but after reading the book Salvation and the Harp of God, he knew that he had found the truth. Early one Sunday morning in 1941, Zacchaeus set off to attend his first witness meeting, which was 5 miles away and down a steep mountain. Not knowing when the meeting would begin, he arrived several hours early. Zacchaeus sat and waited for the brothers to arrive. After attending 3 Sunday meetings at the Kingdom Hall, he told the local Anglican church to take his name off the membership roll. A close friend who attended that church chided him, saying, "Old man, if you continue to walk those 5 miles up and down this mountain to go to the hall of those people, you will be dead within a year." He watched Zacchaeus walk up and down the mountain twice a week for 5 years. Then the friend dropped dead. 25 years later, Zacchaeus was still feeling fit. Zacchaeus faithfully served Jehovah until his death at the age of 97.
They called him Bible Brown. William R. Brown, born 1879, baptized 1908. Profile: spearheaded the early preaching work in West Africa.
While working on the Panama Canal in 1907, William came across a street corner lecture being given by Isaiah Richards, a Bible student, as Jehovah's Witnesses were then called. Richards based his talk on the chart of the ages, a diagram used to explain God's purposes. William quickly accepted the truth and returned to Jamaica to share it with his mother and sister. In time, they too became Bible students. For a time, Brother Brown served in Panama City, Panama. There he met Evander J. Coward, a traveling representative of the Bible students, who was visiting Panama on a lecture tour. Coward was an emphatic and colorful speaker, and crowds flocked to hear him. When he saw that William was zealous for the truth, he invited him to accompany him on a preaching tour of Trinidad. Over the next 10 years or so, William traveled throughout the West Indies, pioneering and strengthening small groups. In 1920, he married Antonia, a faithful Christian sister. 2 days after their wedding, William and Antonia sailed to the tiny island of Montserrat in the Leeward Islands, bringing with them the Photo Drama of Creation, a 4-part motion picture and slide presentation based on the Bible. They also preached on the islands of Barbados, Dominica, and Grenada. They had a joyful honeymoon in Jehovah's service. 2 years later, William wrote to Joseph F. Rutherford, who was overseeing the work of Jehovah's people at the time, saying, "By Jehovah's help, I have given the witness throughout the majority of the Caribbean islands and made disciples in many. Should I go over them again?" Within days, Brother Rutherford replied, "Proceed to Sierra Leone, West Africa, with wife and child." During the 27 years that Brother Brown served with his family in West Africa, he never felt at home sitting in an office. He preferred to be out preaching. Because he emphasized the importance of the Bible, people began calling him Bible Brown. In 1950, when he was 71 years old, William Brown and his wife returned to Jamaica to pioneer. William pioneered until he finished his earthly course in 1967. How he loved pioneering! He felt that it was one of the highest privileges a human could have.
(1945–1990) Bringing many to righteousness. Gilead missionaries arrive. In June 1947, 3 graduates of the Watchtower Bible School of Gilead, Charles Fitzpatrick, George Richardson, and Hubert Gresham, arrived in Freetown. These brothers were the first of many missionaries to come. The missionaries saw that the local publishers were eager to preach, but they needed to become more effective teachers. So the missionaries started by teaching the publishers how to follow up on the interest shown and how to conduct Bible studies. They also passed on up-to-date direction about congregation meetings and theocratic organization. A public meeting was held at Wilberforce Memorial Hall. To the missionaries' delight, 450 persons attended. Later, the missionaries introduced a weekly magazine day. This training galvanized the congregation and laid the foundation for future increase. Meanwhile, the missionaries struggled to adapt to the climate. A 1948 branch report states, "Climatic conditions in Sierra Leone are very trying. The rainy season lasts 6 months of the year, and the rain is heavy, torrential, and continuous. Sometimes it rains for 2 weeks without let-up. During the dry season, the heat is intense and the humidity high." Early European visitors to Sierra Leone had dubbed it the white man's graveyard. Malaria, yellow fever, and other tropical diseases ran rampant. One by one, the missionaries fell sick and had to leave. Understandably, the local publishers were dismayed by these developments, but they did not give up. Between 1947 and 1952, the peak publishers increased from 38 to 73. In Waterloo, a town near Freetown, hard-working pioneers helped to establish a new congregation. New study groups emerged in Kisii and in Wellington, both located on the outskirts of Freetown. Sierra Leone seemed ready to expand. All that was needed was the right catalyst. A strengthening visit. In November 1952, a slender American in his early 30s stepped ashore at the jetty in Freetown and joined the hubbub of the city. The visitor, Milton G. Henschel from World Headquarters, recalled, "I was quite amazed to see a modern city much cleaner than many in most parts of the world. Paved streets, busy shops, new cars, and an endless stream of people passed by." Brother Henschel walked to the Freetown missionary home, located 2 blocks from the famous cotton tree. There he informed the assembled brothers that Sierra Leone would receive more help. The following Sunday, 253 people crowded into Wilberforce Memorial Hall to hear him deliver a series of exciting announcements. Sierra Leone would have its own branch office, circuit overseer, and circuit assemblies. A new congregation would be formed in Kisii, and the preaching work in the provinces would be greatly expanded. The audience was thrilled. Brother Henschel related, "They kept saying, 'Couché,' a very expressive word meaning, 'well done.' The brothers were in high spirits. Groups departed from the hall in the evening darkness, some conventioners singing songs." A newly arrived missionary, William Nushi, was appointed to oversee the new branch office. William had previously worked as a card and dice dealer in casinos across the United States. After becoming a Christian, he left that work and firmly upheld righteous principles, a trait that would win him the love and respect of the publishers in Sierra Leone. They wanted to see it. In 1956, the brothers in Freetown screened the film The New World Society in Action. They reported, "We rented the largest hall in Freetown and distributed 1,000 invitations. We wondered just how many would come. Half an hour before the film began, only 25 people had arrived. Over the next 15 minutes, 100 more came. Soon, all 500 seats were filled. 100 more were happy to stand. Another 500 stood outside, unable to enter. Would they wait for a second showing? Yes, they said. And so they did, even though it was raining. Over the years, more than 80,000 people throughout Sierra Leone turned out to see this and other remarkable films." Honoring God's gift of marriage. As William Nushi settled into his assignment, he saw that some publishers were not upholding Jehovah's standard for marriage. Some couples had common law marriages, living together as man and wife without registering their union with the civil authorities. Others followed the local custom of putting off marriage until the woman became pregnant, thus ensuring that their union would be fruitful. Accordingly, in May 1953, the branch office wrote to each congregation and clearly explained the Bible's standard on marriage. Couples were given time to register their marriage. If they did not do so, they would face being removed from the congregation. Most publishers rejoiced at this refinement, yet some were permissive and independent. More than half the publishers in two congregations stopped associating with Jehovah's organization. Those who stayed loyal, though, actually increased their activity, clear evidence that Jehovah was blessing them. After much effort on the part of the brothers, the Freetown Kingdom Hall was recognized as a proper place to solemnize marriages. On September 3, 1954, the brothers performed their first official marriage ceremony. Later, the government supplied marriage registers to qualified brothers in 7 districts throughout the country. This allowed more interested people to legalize their marriages and to qualify as publishers of the Good News. Many interested people who practiced polygamy also took steps to conform to God's standards. Samuel Cooper, who now lives in Bont, relates, "In 1957, I began attending meetings with my two wives and soon enrolled in the Theocratic Ministry School. One day, I was assigned a talk on the topic of Christian marriage. As I researched the talk, I realized that I needed to dismiss my junior wife. When I told my relatives, they all opposed me. My junior wife had borne me a child, whereas my senior wife was barren. But I had made up my mind to abide by scriptural principles. To my great surprise, when my junior wife returned to her family, my senior wife began bearing children. Now I have 5 children by my wife who was once barren." when another interested person, Honoré Camano, who lived across the border in Guinea, dismissed the two youngest of his three wives, his senior wife appreciated his stand and started taking the truth more seriously. One of his younger wives, although disappointed at being dismissed, also admired his high regard for Bible principles. She asked for a Bible study and later dedicated her life to Jehovah. Today, Jehovah's Witnesses are well known throughout Sierra Leone and Guinea as a people who honor marriage. Their marital fidelity adorns God's teachings and praises Him as the author of the marriage arrangement. Dissent in Freetown. In 1956, two more Gilead graduates, Charles and Reva Chapel, arrived in Freetown. On their way to the missionary home, they were taken aback by a large sign advertising a Bible lecture at Wilberforce Memorial Hall. The advertised speaker was C.N.D. Jones, says Charles, a representative of the Ecclesia of Jehovah's Witnesses. Jones, who professed to be one of the anointed, led a splinter group that had broken away from the congregation in Freetown several years earlier. His group claimed to be true witnesses of Jehovah and labeled the missionaries and those loyal to the organization's representatives as imposters and Gilead cowboys. Matters came to a head when Jones and some of his supporters were disfellowshipped. This announcement shocked some brothers who favored showing tolerance toward the dissenters, says Chapel. A few voiced their dissatisfaction publicly. They and others kept associating with the rebels and tried to disrupt meetings and field service arrangements. The disgruntled ones sat together at the meetings in an area dubbed Dissenters' Row. Most eventually fell away from the truth, but some regained their spiritual balance and became zealous publishers. The loyal stand taken by the majority kept the way open for a free flow of God's Spirit. When Zone Overseer Harry Arnott visited Freetown the following year, he reported, "This is the first solid increase that we've had in Sierra Leone for some years. This gives good cause for optimism for future progress." Teaching the Kisi. Soon after Brother Arnott's visit, Charles Chapel received a letter from a brother in neighboring Liberia. The brother wanted to open up the preaching work among his kinsmen in Sierra Leone. He belonged to the Kisi tribe, who occupied the forested hills and valleys spanning the junction of Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. It seemed that many Kisi-speaking people wanted to understand the Bible. Since most of the Kisi could not read or write, literacy classes were arranged in Koindu to teach basic Bible truths. These classes attracted hundreds of students. Soon the group had 5 new publishers, then 10, then 15, then 20, Charles recalls. "People came into the truth so fast that I doubted whether they were genuine publishers. But I was wrong. Most of them were not only faithful, but zealous as well." The eager new publishers soon spread the good news beyond Koindu and eventually into neighboring Guinea. Trekking for hours across the rolling landscape, they preached on farms and in villages. "For weeks, sometimes months, we never heard the sound of a motor vehicle," says Eliezer Awudowi, a circuit overseer at the time. As the Kisi brothers and sisters spread and watered the kingdom seed, God made it grow. When one young blind man heard the truth, he memorized the 32-page booklet, This Good News of the Kingdom. Later, he recalled paragraphs at will while preaching and conducting Bible studies of his own. This amazed onlookers. One deaf woman who accepted the truth made such big changes that her sister-in-law started attending meetings, walking more than 6 miles to get there. The work among the Kisi grew by leaps and bounds. Another congregation was formed, and then another. About 30 publishers took up the pioneer ministry. The Koindu town chief became interested in the truth and donated a plot of land to build a kingdom hall. when over 500 people attended a circuit assembly at Kailahun, a congregation was formed there too. Soon half of the witnesses in Sierra Leone were Kisi, although the tribe made up less than 2% of the population. This progress did not please everyone, especially the Kisi religious leaders. Filled with jealousy, they determined to stamp out this threat to their authority. The question was, how and when would they strike? Confronting the Paro. The first attack came in a village near Koindu, where a group of men were studying the Bible and regularly attending meetings. Like most Kisi males, the men belonged to the Paro, a secret society steeped in spiritism. When the Bible students refused to share in demonic rites, the Paro headman was furious, explains James Mensah, a Gilead-trained missionary who also served in Sierra Leone. The headman and his supporters beat the men, stole their property, burned their homes, chained them, and left them in the bush to starve to death. The paramount chief egged the Paro members on. Despite this abuse, the Bible students stood firm. When the brothers in Koindu reported the matter to the police, the Paro headman, his cronies, and the paramount chief were arrested. They were tried and severely reprimanded, and the paramount chief was suspended for nearly a year. This legal victory became widely known and emboldened more new ones to start attending meetings. Later, the paramount chief had a change of heart and became interested in the truth. When a circuit assembly was held in his area, he accommodated visiting delegates and even donated a large cow. Other Paro leaders tried a different form of attack, craftily framing trouble in the name of the law. Psalm 94:20. Paro politicians tabled a motion in Parliament banning the work of Jehovah's Witnesses. Yet the paramount chief rose to our defense, telling the assembly that he had been studying with us for 2 years, says Charles Chapel. He said that our organization was entirely non-political and that it educated the people and uplifted their morals. He then declared that he hoped to become a member one day. When another member of Parliament who had also studied supported him, the motion was dropped. Those who left the secret societies faced severe opposition from their families. Jonathan Seliu, a teenager from Koindu, had forefathers who were juju priests going back 4 generations. He was being groomed to do the same work. When he started studying the Bible, he put away his spiritistic rituals and sacrifices. His family bitterly opposed him, removing him from school and refusing to feed him when he went to Christian meetings. "Let God feed you," they taunted. Yet Jonathan stood firm. He did not go hungry. He learned how to read and write, and he later became a regular pioneer. Jonathan rejoiced to see his mother accept the truth. Growth in other areas of the country. In 1960, congregations and isolated groups were located in Bo, Freetown, Kisi, Koindu, Lansar, Magbraka, Makeni, Moyamba, Port Loko, Waterloo, and as far north as Kabala. The number of publishers that year jumped from 182 to 282. Many special pioneers from Ghana and Nigeria arrived to strengthen the growing congregations. Most of the new ones belonged to 2 groups, the Creole, who lived in and around Freetown, and the Kisi, who lived in the eastern province. But as the good news continued to spread, other tribes began responding too. These included the Kuranka, the Limba, and the Temni in the north, the Mendi in the south, and other ethnic groups. In 1961, the Freetown East congregation dedicated their Kingdom Hall. Then the Koindu congregation dedicated a 300-seat mud brick Kingdom Hall that doubled as an assembly hall. Soon afterwards, 40 elders attended the Kingdom Ministry School, Sierra Leone's first. Capping off an outstanding year, the brothers engaged in a successful campaign to offer the New World Translation of the Holy Scriptures to the public. Jehovah was clearly blessing his people. On July 28, 1962, the International Bible Students Association, a legal corporation used by Jehovah's Witnesses in many countries, was officially registered with the Sierra Leone government. Guinea opens up. Let us now turn our attention to neighboring Guinea, formerly called French Guinea. Prior to 1958, a few brothers had briefly witnessed to some while passing through the country, but the French colonial authorities were opposed to our work. However, in 1958, a door of opportunity opened. Guinea renounced French rule and became an independent republic. Later that year, Manuel Diogo, a French-speaking brother from Dahomey, now Benin, who was in his early 30s, started working at a bauxite mine in Fria, a town about 50 miles north of the capital, Conakry. Eager to preach in this untouched territory, Manuel wrote to the France branch asking for literature and for help from special pioneers. His letter concluded, "I pray that Jehovah will bless the work because there is plenty of interest here." The France branch wrote Manuel an encouraging letter and urged him to stay in Guinea as long as possible. The branch also arranged for a special pioneer to visit him in order to train him in the ministry. Manuel thrived on the encouragement and preached zealously in Fria until his death in 1968. When Zone Overseer Wilfred Gooch visited Conakry in 1960, he found two other African brothers preaching there. Brother Gooch recommended that Guinea be cared for by the Sierra Leone branch rather than by the branch office in France. This transfer took place on March 1, 1961. 1 month later, the first congregation in Guinea was formed in Conakry. Spiritual light penetrates the rainforest. The good news was also spreading into southern Guinea. Fala Gondo, a Kisi tribesman who was living in Liberia, returned to his home village, Fodedu, about 8 miles west of Gekedu. He carried with him the book From Paradise Lost to Paradise Regained. Fala could not read, but he was able to explain the pictures in the book to his fellow tribesmen. The book stirred up much discussion, he recalls. People called it the Adam and Eve book. Fala returned to Liberia. He got baptized and eventually became a special pioneer. Twice a month, he returned to Fodedu to study with a group of about 30 people. Soon he was joined by Barbar Sisi, another Kisi special pioneer from Liberia. Together they started another group in Gekedu. Both groups became congregations. As more and more Kisi became witnesses, local chiefs noticed their fine conduct. The witnesses worked hard, they were honest, and they promoted peace in their villages. Accordingly, when brothers asked for permission to build a kingdom hall in Fodedu, the chiefs readily gave them 8 acres of land. That kingdom hall, the first in Guinea, was completed in early 1964. Upheavals in Conakry. Meanwhile, in Conakry, trouble was brewing. Political turmoil prompted government officials to view foreigners with suspicion. 4 Gilead missionaries were refused permanent visas and were deported. 2 Ghanaian brothers were arrested on false charges and imprisoned for nearly 2 months. Following their release, one of the brothers, Emmanuel Owusu Ansah, was promptly rearrested and held in appalling conditions. From a filthy prison cell, he wrote, "I am spiritually healthy, but I have continuous fever. Nevertheless, I can still preach. Last month, I spent 67 hours in field service, and 2 Bible students started preaching with me." One of his students came into the truth. After 5 months, Brother Owusu Ansah was released and was deported to Sierra Leone. Only one publisher remained in Conakry. In 1969, when the political tension had eased, special pioneers arrived in Conakry. With permission from the authorities, they established a kingdom hall with a sign on it. Soon about 30 interested people were regularly attending meetings. Because of the danger of arrest, The brothers preached cautiously at first, but as they gained confidence, they expanded their efforts. During 1973, that small congregation had distributed 6,000 tracts. Later, the publishers began offering magazines in offices and business centers. Slowly, government officials and the public began to understand and appreciate our work. On December 15, 1993, those patient and persistent efforts culminated in the legal registration of the Christian Association of Jehovah's Witnesses of Guinea. Secret societies. Secret societies are widespread throughout West Africa and cut across tribal, cultural, and linguistic lines. These organizations regulate the social, educational, and political activities of their members. Their primary role, however, is religious. Two of the largest secret societies are the Paro, for men, and the Sandi, for women. The footnote reads, "In some areas, Sandi is known as Bondo." End of footnote. The Paro Society, for example, strives to control the spirits and ensure that their intervention in the affairs of men is beneficial. Initiation, 1986. New members of the Paro are taught spiritual secrets and powers of witchcraft, and ritual scars are carved on their bodies. New members of the Sandi also learn spiritistic rituals and typically undergo female genital mutilation, although this practice is being discontinued in some areas. Other secret societies regulate sexual behavior and use spiritistic remedies to try to cure madness or other ailments. During Sierra Leone's civil war, one secret society claimed that its members were immune to bullets. They were not. Members are forbidden to reveal the group's knowledge and rituals to outsiders. A person who flouts the laws and protocols of a secret society risks death. Fighting illiteracy. Early in 1963, during his second visit to Sierra Leone, Milton Henschel addressed a need that the branch had been trying to tackle for some time. He urged the brothers to intensify their efforts to combat illiteracy. Some congregations were conducting literacy classes in English, but after Brother Henschel's visit, the brothers began teaching students to read and write in their mother tongue. Some congregations held classes in two or three languages. These classes were so popular that a third of the publishers in the country enrolled in them. In 1966, brothers in Liberia developed an illustrated Kisi language reading primer. When they showed the primer to the Liberian government officials, the impressed officials decided to print the booklet and to distribute it without cost. The primer was distributed in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, and it helped hundreds of Kisi-speaking people to learn to read and write. Later, primers were developed or adapted for other language groups, helping many more people to become literate. The literacy classes not only taught people to read and write, but also helped them to make spiritual progress. Consider Sia Ngala, a 50-year-old unbaptized publisher who was illiterate. Sia kept track of her witnessing activity with black and red strings. After preaching for an hour, she would tie a knot in the black string. After making a return visit, she would tie a knot in the red string. Sia attended literacy class, which helped her to keep better track of her ministry. She also progressed to baptism and became a more effective preacher and teacher. Today, many congregations in Sierra Leone and Guinea still conduct literacy classes. A senior Sierra Leone government official told brothers at the branch office, "In addition to your Bible educational work, you are doing a meritorious work by helping people in this society to become literate." Stones cry out. As more people from various ethnic groups learned to read, the need for translation increased. Most tribesmen had little, if any, secular literature in their own language. educated people in Sierra Leone read English, while those in Guinea read French. What could be done to provide Bible literature in their native tongue? In 1959, two Gilead graduates translated a tract and a booklet into Mende, but only a limited number of copies were distributed. 10 years later, the booklets This Good News of the Kingdom and Living in Hope of a Righteous New World were translated into Kisi. About 30,000 of these booklets were distributed and used to conduct Bible studies. In 1975, the branch office began publishing Watchtower study articles in Kisi. The Kisi publishers were thrilled. One brother wrote, "Jehovah has performed a great wonder in our behalf. None of us have ever been to school. We were like stones, unable to talk. That is how we were, but now that we have the Watchtower in Kisi, we can speak of Jehovah's great acts." Several other publications were also translated into Kisi. Today, most people in Sierra Leone and Guinea still read our publications in English or French, which are the languages used at congregation meetings. But recently, the number of vernacular publications has dramatically increased. Bible literature is now available in Gwersi, Kisi, Creole, Maninkakan, Mende, Puar, and Susu. The brochures Listen to God and Live Forever and Listen to God are available in all these languages. These easy-to-use teaching aids are helping many people with limited reading ability to grasp and appreciate the Bible's marvelous message. Building a branch office. During the early 1960s, the brothers in Freetown had been searching for land on which to build a new branch office. Finally, in 1965, they acquired property on Wilkinson Road. The land overlooked the ocean in one of the finest residential areas of the city. The final design combined a kingdom hall, a missionary home, and work offices into one attractive building. During construction, heavy traffic along Wilkinson Road often slowed down almost to a standstill as drivers and passengers tried to get a better view. The building was dedicated on August 19, 1967. Nearly 300 people attended the program, including local dignitaries and several old-timers who were baptized by Bible Brown in 1923. The new branch building elevated the work of Jehovah's Witnesses in the minds of many people. It also answered some religious critics who said that the Witnesses would not last in Sierra Leone. The new building clearly proclaimed that Jehovah's Witnesses were here to stay. Zealous missionaries stimulate growth. From the mid-1970s onward, a steady stream of Gilead-trained missionaries boosted the work in Sierra Leone and Guinea. Some had served in other African lands and quickly adapted to the local conditions. Others were new to Africa. How would they cope with the white man's graveyard? Consider some of their comments.
People were humble and spiritually starved. Seeing the truth improve their lives brought me great satisfaction.
Hannelore Altmaier.
Dealing with the tropical climate and disease was a challenge, but the joy of helping honest-hearted ones serve Jehovah was worth it.
Cheryl Ferguson.
I learned to develop patience. When I asked a sister when her visitors would arrive, she replied, "Maybe today, maybe tomorrow, or maybe the next day." I must have looked shocked because she insisted, "But they will come."
Christine Jones.
14 missionaries from different ethnic and cultural backgrounds lived in the Freetown missionary home. We shared 2 toilets, 1 shower, 1 washing machine, and 1 kitchen. Food supplies were limited and of poor quality. The electricity would fail unpredictably, sometimes for days. Most of us suffered from malaria and other tropical diseases.
Though this may sound like a recipe for disaster, We learned to live together, to forgive, and to find humor in difficult situations. Preaching was a delight, and the missionaries forged close bonds of friendship.
Robert and Pauline Landis.
Our time in Sierra Leone was among the best days of our lives.
We have no regrets and no complaints. We just miss it very much.
Benjamin and Monica Martin.
Once, we stayed with an interested woman who offered us a strange-looking meal. "It's viper," she said. "I've removed the fangs. Would you like some?" We tactfully declined, but she insisted.
As daunting as such experiences were, we appreciated our host's warm hospitality and grew to love them very much.
Frederick and Barbara Morrissey.
During my 43 years of missionary service, I have lived with over 100 other missionaries. What a privilege it has been to come to know so many people, all having different personalities, yet all working with the same objective. And what a joy to be a fellow worker with God and to have a share in seeing people embrace Bible truth.
Lynette Peters. Since 1947, 154 missionaries have served in Sierra Leone and 88 in Guinea. Many other witnesses came to serve where the need was greater. Today, there are 44 missionaries in Sierra Leone and 31 in Guinea. Their tireless efforts and selfless devotion have touched the lives of countless individuals. Alfred Gunn, a longtime member of the branch committee, says, "We think of them with great fondness." A lapel card was their passport.
In 1987, more than 1,000 delegates attended the Trust in Jehovah District Convention in Gakedu, Guinea. Since the convention site was near the Sierra Leone and Liberia borders, many delegates from those countries decided to commute each day. However, they lacked the proper travel documents. So responsible brothers negotiated with the border authorities and reached an agreement. Delegates would need only one document, their convention lapel card. When the border police saw the bright orange cards, they immediately waved the delegates through. Everett Berry, former missionary.
Jehovah raised me up. J. Campbell, born 1966, baptized 1986. Profile: a polio victim who became a regular pioneer.
I grew up crippled from the waist down, and I lived in a compound in Freetown with my mother and several other poverty-stricken families. Ashamed and afraid of how strangers might view me, I ventured outside the compound only once in 18 years. When I was 18 years old, Pauline Landis, a witness missionary, called at my compound and offered to teach me the Bible. When I told her that I could not read or write, Pauline said that she would teach me that too, so I agreed. What I learned from the Bible filled me with joy. One day, I asked Pauline if I could attend a congregation meeting in a home about a block away. "I'll walk there on my wooden walking blocks," I said. When Pauline came to pick me up, my mother and my neighbors watched me apprehensively. Gripping my wooden walking blocks, I reached forward and placed them on the ground. Then I swung my body up and passed the blocks. As I made my way across the courtyard, my neighbors yelled at Pauline, "You are forcing her. She has tried to walk before and failed." "Jay, do you want to come?" asked Pauline gently. "Yes," I replied. "This is my decision." My neighbors watched quietly as I approached the gate. When I exited the compound, they erupted in cheers. How I enjoyed that meeting! Next, I was determined to get to the Kingdom Hall. That involved walking to the end of the street, taking a taxi ride, and then getting brothers to carry me up a steep hill. I often arrived wet and muddy and had to change my clothes at the hall. Later, a sister in Switzerland kindly sent me a wheelchair, which allowed me to travel with dignity. Reading the experiences of other disabled witnesses motivated me to serve Jehovah more fully. In 1988, I became a regular pioneer. I prayed to Jehovah to help me reach my goal, which was to help someone in my family and someone in my territory to become a servant of Jehovah. My prayers were answered when I was able to help two of my nephews and a woman I met while street witnessing learn the truth. Now my arms have lost their strength, and I depend on others to wheel me around. I also suffer from chronic pain. But I have found that one remedy for pain is teaching others about Jehovah. The joy it gives me eases my pain and comforts me because Jehovah raised me up, and now I lead a purposeful life.
(1991 to 2001) A Furnace of Affliction, Isaiah 48:10. Civil War. During the 1980s, social, political, and economic problems kindled dissent throughout West Africa. When war ravaged neighboring Liberia, many fled to Sierra Leone. The branch arranged for homes and kingdom halls to be used to house the witness refugees, and the brothers took care of their needs. Though times were hard for the refugees, there were some amusing moments. Isolde Lorenz, a longtime missionary, relates, a young boy was sent by his father to warm up some food in the fireplace that was set up in the garden behind the kingdom hall, which was located on the branch's property. When the boy came back, he told his father that there would be no food today. The father asked why. "Because," exclaimed the boy, "today Jehovah has saved me from the mouth of the lion." What had happened? On his way back with the food, the boy had met the branch's large, but rather harmless, German shepherd named Lobo. The boy had the fright of his life. While holding the plate of food, he had stretched his hands out as far as possible to ward off the dog. Lobo, of course, considered this as an invitation to help itself. And that's exactly what Lobo did. On March 23, 1991, the armed conflict in Liberia spilled across the border into Sierra Leone, igniting an 11-year civil war. A rebel group called the Revolutionary United Front, or RUF, advanced rapidly on Kailahun and Koindu, prompting most of the local population to flee to Guinea. Among the refugees were about 120 brothers and sisters. Meanwhile, other witness refugees from Liberia flooded into Sierra Leone ahead of the rebels. For several months, groups of haggard, emaciated, hungry brothers arrived at Freetown Bethel, says Billy Cowan, the branch committee coordinator at the time. Many had witnessed unspeakable atrocities and had avoided starvation by eating wild herbs. We quickly gave them food and clothing and cared for the relatives and interested ones who accompanied them. The local brothers and sisters opened their hearts and their homes to the refugees. The witness refugees immediately got busy in field service, helping the local congregations. In time, most of them moved on, but while they were here, they strengthened us. Sharing comfort and hope. The branch office sent food, medicine, building materials, tools, and utensils to witnesses in refugee camps in southern Guinea. This included a large supply of donated clothing from France. "My children were dancing, singing, and praising Jehovah," one father wrote. They had new clothes to wear to the meetings. Some brothers and sisters said that they had never dressed better. The refugees, though, needed more than material aid. Jesus said, "Man must live not on bread alone, but on every word that comes from Jehovah's mouth." Matthew 4:4. So the branch office sent Bible literature to the region and organized regular assemblies and conventions. Pioneers and traveling overseers were also sent to the area. When circuit overseer André Bott visited Kundu, Guinea, he met a camp official who invited him to give a Bible talk for the local refugees. About 50 people heard André speak on the theme, "Take Refuge in Jehovah," based on Psalm 18. When he finished, an elderly woman rose and spoke. "You have made us very happy," she said. "Rice does not solve our problems, but the Bible shows us how to hope in God. We thank you from the bottom of our hearts for bringing us comfort and hope." When missionaries William and Claudia Slaughter were assigned to Gekedu, Guinea, the congregation of over 100 refugees was aglow with the Spirit. "Many young men were reaching out spiritually," says William. "If someone could not give his assigned talk on the Theocratic Ministry School, 10 to 15 young brothers would volunteer to take his place. Large groups were out in service zealously preaching. Some of those zealous young men later became special pioneers and traveling overseers." Construction amid conflict. Soon after the Civil War began, the brothers in Freetown purchased a 1.5-acre property at 133 Wilkinson Road, a few hundred feet down the road from the branch office. "We wanted to build a new Bethel home on the site, but were concerned about the war," says Alfred Gunn. "Since Lloyd Barry of the governing body was visiting us at the time, we raised our concerns with him. He replied, 'If we let wars hold us back, we will never get anything done.' His stirring words gave us courage to move ahead." Hundreds of brothers labored on the project, including over 50 volunteers from 12 different countries and many willing helpers from local congregations. Work began in May 1991. Onlookers were impressed with the high-quality blocks that were made on-site. "The steel stud structure was very different from local buildings," says Tom Ball, the construction overseer. "But the people were more amazed to see white foreigners and black locals working unitedly and happily together on the project." On April 19, 1997, a multinational crowd joyfully assembled for the dedication of the new branch facilities. 1 month later, after 5 years of savage rural conflict, the RUF attacked Freetown. Battle for Freetown. Thousands of RUF fighters with matted hair and red headbands surged through the city, looting, raping, and killing. "The situation was extremely tense," recalls Alfred Gunn. "Most of the foreign missionaries were quickly evacuated. The last to leave were Billy and Sandra Cowan, Jimmy and Joyce Holland, and Catherine and me. We prayed with the local Bethelites who volunteered to stay behind, and then we hurried to the evacuation point. Along the way, we were stopped by about 20 wild-looking, drunken rebel soldiers. When we gave them magazines and money, they let us pass. Along with more than 1,000 other evacuees, we converged on a fortified checkpoint manned by heavily armed U.S. Marines. There we boarded a military helicopter and were whisked offshore to a U.S. naval ship. A ship officer later told us that our civilian evacuation had been the largest conducted by the U.S. Navy since the Vietnam War. The following day, we flew by helicopter to Conakry, Guinea. There we set up a temporary branch office." The missionaries anxiously awaited news from Freetown. Finally, a letter arrived stating, "Amid the chaos, we are still distributing Kingdom News number 35. Will all people ever love one another? People are really responding, and even some of the rebels are studying with us. We have thus resolved to intensify our preaching activities." Jonathan Mboma, who was serving as a circuit overseer, recalls, "We even held a special assembly day in Freetown. The program was so spiritually motivating that I traveled to Bo and Kenema to hold the program in those areas. The brothers in those war-torn towns thanked Jehovah for the wonderful spiritual food. In late 1997, we held a district convention at the National Stadium in Freetown. On the final day of the program, rebel soldiers entered the stadium and ordered us to leave. We pleaded with them to let us finish the program. After a long discussion, they relented and left. Over 1,000 people attended the convention, and 27 were baptized. Several brothers made the perilous trip to Bo and heard the program again there. What wonderful, thrilling conventions they were! Conflict Diamonds. During the 11-year-long civil war, various factions targeted Sierra Leone's rich diamond mines in order to fund their military activities. That was one of the findings of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Sierra Leone. Conflict diamonds were smuggled abroad and sold to dealers who ignored their origin, tragically prolonging the war. Bethel attacked. In February 1998, government soldiers and troops from the Economic Community of West African States Monitoring Group, or ECOMOG, launched an all-out offensive to evict the rebel forces from Freetown. Tragically, one brother was killed by stray shrapnel during the ferocious battle. Some 150 publishers took shelter at the Kasee and Cockerel missionary homes. Laddie Sandy, one of two Bethel Night watchmen, relates, "Late one night, while Philip Touré and I were on duty, two armed RUF rebels appeared at Bethel and demanded that we open the glass lobby doors. As Philip and I leaped to safety, they repeatedly shot into the door lock. Remarkably, it held, and they did not think to shoot out the glass panes. Frustrated, they left. Two nights later, the rebels returned with about 20 determined, well-equipped companions. We quickly alerted the Bethel family and ran to a prearranged refuge in the basement. Seven of us hid in the dark behind two large barrels, shaking with fear. The rebels shot their way into the building, melting the door lock in the process. 'Look for those Jehovah's Witnesses and cut their throats,' one rebel bellowed. We crouched in silence as they ransacked the building for 7 hours. Finally satisfied with their night's work, they left. We gathered our personal belongings and ran to the Cockerel Missionary Home, the old Bethel home, just up the road. Along the way, we were robbed by another group of rebels. We arrived at the missionary home badly shaken, but grateful to be alive. After resting a few days, we returned to Bethel to clean up the mess. 2 months later, after ECOMOG forces were in control of the city, the missionaries began returning from Guinea. Little did they know, though, that their stay would be brief. Operation No Living Thing. 8 months later, in December 1998, hundreds of delegates at Freetown's National Stadium were enjoying the God's Way of Life District Convention. Suddenly, they heard a low boom, and a plume of smoke rose from the hills. The rebel army had returned. In the days that followed, the situation in Freetown worsened. The branch committee chartered a small plane and evacuated 12 missionaries, 8 foreign Bethelites, and 5 construction volunteers to Conakry. 3 days later, on January 6, 1999, rebel forces launched a brutal killing campaign called Operation No Living Thing. With terrifying violence, they ravaged Freetown, massacring some 6,000 civilians. The rebels amputated arms and legs at random, abducted hundreds of children, and destroyed thousands of buildings. One much-loved brother, Edward Toby, was brutally murdered. More than 200 traumatized publishers were housed either at Bethel or at the Cockerel Missionary Home. Others hid in their homes. The witnesses who had taken shelter at the Kasee Missionary Home, located on the east end of town, desperately needed medication, but crossing the city was highly dangerous. Who would risk it? Laddie Sandy and Philip Touré, the intrepid Bethel Night Watchman, immediately volunteered. The city was chaotic, Philip recalls. Rebel soldiers manned numerous checkpoints, harassing people at will. A strict curfew ran from mid-afternoon to mid-morning, limiting our ability to travel. 2 days after starting out on our journey, we reached the Kisi missionary home, only to find that it had been ransacked and burned. Checking the surrounding area, we found one of our brothers, Andrew Calker, who had horrific head wounds. Rebels had bound him and struck him repeatedly with an axe. Amazingly, he survived and had managed to escape. We rushed him to the hospital, where he slowly recovered. Later, he served as a regular pioneer. Other witnesses were spared death or injury because of their reputation as Christian neutrals. One brother relates, "The rebels demanded that we don white bandanas and dance in the street to support their cause. If you refuse, we will hack off your arm or leg or kill you," they told us. Terrified, my wife and I stepped aside, quietly praying for Jehovah's help. Seeing our plight, a young neighbor who was collaborating with the rebels told the rebel commander, "This is our brother. He doesn't get involved in politics, so we will dance for him." Satisfied, the commander turned away, and we hurried home. As an eerie calm descended over the city, the brothers cautiously resumed meetings and field service. Publishers wore convention lapel cards to identify themselves at checkpoints. Brothers waiting in the long checkpoint queues became skilled at starting Bible conversations. As shortages of all sorts gripped the city, the Britain branch flew in 200 cartons of relief aid. Billy Cowan and Alan Jones flew from Conakry to Freetown to escort the shipment through a succession of checkpoints. The shipment reached Bethel just before the evening curfew. James Karoma made courier trips to Conakry, returning with literature and other vital supplies. Some of this spiritual food was forwarded to isolated publishers in Bow and Kenema. On August 9, 1999, the missionaries in Conakry started returning to Freetown. The following year, a British armed expeditionary force drove the rebels out of Freetown. Sporadic fighting continued for a while, but by January 2002, the war was declared over. As a result of the 11-year conflict, 50,000 people were killed, 20,000 were maimed, 300,000 homes were destroyed, and 1.2 million people were displaced. How had Jehovah's organization fared? Jehovah had clearly protected and blessed it. During the conflict, about 700 people were baptized. Hundreds of witnesses had fled the war zone, yet the number of publishers in Sierra Leone increased by 50%. Guinea had an increase in publishers of over 300%. More important, God's people had maintained their integrity. In a furnace of affliction, they had displayed unbreakable Christian unity and love, and had continued without let-up teaching and declaring the good news. Isaiah 48:10 and Acts 5:42. From child soldier to regular pioneer.
I was 16 years old when rebel soldiers forced me to join their army. They supplied me with drugs and alcohol, and I often fought in a drug-crazed state. I fought many battles and committed terrible atrocities. This I deeply regret. One day an elderly witness preached at our barracks. Most people feared and despised us rebels, yet he was reaching out to help us spiritually. When he invited me to a meeting, I accepted. I don't remember what was said at the meeting, but I clearly remember the warm welcome I received. When the war heated up, I lost contact with the witnesses. Then I was seriously wounded and was sent to a rebel-controlled area to recuperate. Before the war ended, I escaped to a government-controlled area and entered a program to disarm, demobilize, and reintegrate combatants into society. I desperately wanted spiritual help. I attended Pentecostal meetings, but the church members called me the Satan in their midst. So I started searching for Jehovah's Witnesses. After I found them, I began to study and attend meetings. When I confessed to my wicked deeds, the brothers read to me Jesus' comforting words: "Healthy people do not need a physician, but those who are ill do. I came to call not righteous people, but sinners." Matthew 9:12-13. How those words touched my heart. I handed my dagger to the brother with whom I was studying the Bible, saying, "I kept this weapon for protection against reprisals. But now that I know that Jehovah and Jesus love me, I don't want it anymore." The brothers taught me how to read and write. Eventually, I was baptized and became a regular pioneer. Today, when I preach to former rebels, they say that they respect me for cleaning up my life. I even studied with the adjutant of my former platoon. When I was a soldier, I fathered 3 boys. After learning the truth, I wanted to help them spiritually. To my delight, 2 of them responded. One of my sons is an unbaptized publisher, and my oldest son is now an auxiliary pioneer.
We escaped from rebel soldiers. Andrew Bond, born 1961, baptized 1988. Profile: a regular pioneer in Pendembu, Eastern Province, Sierra Leone, when the war broke out in 1991.
One afternoon, rebels entered our town, firing their guns into the air for about 2 hours. Some were young teenagers who struggled to carry their weapons. They were very dirty, had wild, unkempt hair, and seemed to be under the influence of drugs. The following day, the killing started. People were brutally maimed or executed. Women were raped. It was chaotic. Brother Amara Babawo and his family and 4 interested people took refuge at my house. We were terrified. Soon, a rebel commander appeared and ordered us to report for military training the following morning. We were determined to stay neutral, although refusal meant death. We prayed most of that night. Rising early, we considered the day's text and waited for the rebels to come. They never came. Later, a rebel officer and 4 of his men commandeered my house. They told us to stay, so we continued to hold regular meetings and to discuss the daily text at home. Some soldiers said, "You are reading the daily text. You must be Jehovah's Witnesses." They were not interested in the Bible, but they respected us. One day, a senior commander came to inspect the troops who were billeted at my home. He saluted Brother Bubba Woe and shook his hand. Addressing the soldiers, the commander barked, "This man is my boss and yours. If one hair falls from his head or the heads of those with him, it will mean trouble for you. Do you understand?" "Yes, sir," they replied. The commander then gave us a letter ordering the Revolutionary United Front not to harm us because we were peaceful citizens. Several months later, rebel factions began fighting each other, so we fled to neighboring Liberia. There, we were threatened by another rebel group. "We are Jehovah's Witnesses," we told them. "Then what does John 3:16 say?" a soldier asked. When we recited the verse, he let us go. Later, we met another rebel commander who ordered Brother Bubba Woe and me to accompany him. We feared for our lives. Then the rebel told us that he had studied with the Witnesses before the war. He gave us money and took a letter from us and carried it to the brothers in a nearby congregation. Soon afterward, two brothers arrived with relief supplies and led us to safety.
The Watchtower Man. James Koroma, born 1966, baptized 1990. Profile: served as a courier during the Civil War.
In 1997, while rebel and government forces battled it out in Freetown, I volunteered to carry correspondence from Freetown to the temporary branch office in Conakry, Guinea. At the city bus station, I boarded a bus with a group of other men. Gunfire echoed in the distance, filling us with fear. As we drove through the city streets, a barrage of gunfire erupted around us. Our driver backtracked and took another route. Soon afterward, we were stopped by a group of rebel gunmen who ordered us out of the vehicle. After questioning us, they let us pass. Later, we were stopped by another group of soldiers. Because one of our passengers knew their commander, they too let us go. At the edge of town, we met a third group of rebels who questioned us but then ordered us to move on. As we made our way north, we passed many more roadblocks until early that evening when our dusty vehicle rolled into Conakry. During later trips, I carried cartons of literature, office equipment, branch records, and relief supplies. I traveled mostly by car and minibus, but I also used porters and canoes to lug literature through rainforest and across rivers. Once, while carrying equipment from Freetown to Conakry, the minibus that I was in was stopped at the border by rebel soldiers. One of them spotted my luggage and began to question me suspiciously. Just then, I saw a former schoolmate among the rebels. The soldiers were calling him Roughneck, and he was the most ferocious-looking soldier of the bunch. I told my questioner that I had come to see Roughneck, and then I called out to him. Roughneck instantly recognized me and ran to meet me. We embraced and laughed. Then he turned serious. "Are you having any problems?" he asked. "I'm trying to cross into Guinea," I replied. He promptly ordered the soldiers to let our minibus pass through the checkpoint uninspected. From that day forward, whenever I stopped at that checkpoint, Roughneck ordered the soldiers to let me pass. I gave the soldiers copies of our magazines, which they appreciated very much. Soon they were calling me the Watchtower Man.
Something better than diamonds. Tamba Josiah, born 1948, baptized 1972. Profile: worked in diamond mines before coming into the truth. He is now a member of the Sierra Leone Branch Committee.
In 1970, I worked for a British mining company in Tongo Fields, a diamond-rich area north of Kenema. I also prospected for diamonds in my spare time. Whenever I found my own stones, I dressed up and headed to Kenema to sell the gems and to have a good time. In 1972, I met Jehovah's Witnesses and started studying the Bible. 5 months later, I qualified for baptism. Since I had no vacation time left, I asked a co-worker to cover my shift so that I could attend the district convention and get baptized. He agreed, but only on the condition that I give him 1 week's salary. My baptism meant more to me than money, so I readily accepted his offer. When I returned from the convention, he told me to keep my wages because serving God was the right thing to do. 6 months later, I left my well-paying job to store up treasures in heaven as a special pioneer. For 18 years, I served as a special pioneer and a circuit overseer in various parts of the country. Meanwhile, I married Christiana, a loyal and supportive partner, and we were blessed with a daughter, Lynette. During Sierra Leone's Civil War, Christiana and I pioneered in Bo, which is located in another major diamond mining area, Here we found many spiritual diamonds, genuine Christian disciples. Within 4 years, our congregation grew by more than 60%. Now Bo has 3 thriving congregations. In 2002, I was invited to become a member of the Sierra Leone Branch Committee. Christiana and I live near Bethel. I commute to work each day while Christiana serves as a special pioneer. Lynette works at Bethel on the Creole translation team. I once dreamed of finding literal diamonds, but I found something much better, spiritual riches. I also unearthed 18 spiritual diamonds, or true Christian disciples. Truly, Jehovah has blessed me beyond measure.
2002 to 2013. Recent developments. Jehovah, thank you. As conditions stabilized, brothers and sisters returned to what was left of their homes. Congregations that were disbanded during the war sprang to life, especially in Sierra Leone's war-torn east. Special pioneers from one area reported, 16 people attended our first meeting, 36 came to the next, 56 enjoyed the one after that, and then 77 attended the memorial. We were thrilled. 9 new congregations were formed, bringing the total to 24. 10 new Gilead missionaries arrived, adding fresh impetus to the preaching work. In 2004, the memorial attendance was 7,594, over 5 times the total publishers. Similar growth occurred in Guinea. The governing body swiftly released emergency funds to help the returning refugees get established. Mobile teams of relief volunteers built or repaired 12 kingdom halls and an assembly hall in Koindu. They also constructed 42 modest mud brick dwellings to accommodate families whose homes had been destroyed. Standing beside her new corrugated iron-roofed house with tears of joy running down her face, one widowed sister in her 70s shouted, "Jehovah, thank you! Jehovah, thank you! Brothers, thank you!" The branch office also began building kingdom halls with funds from the Program for Lands with Limited Resources. Saidu Juana, an elder and a pioneer in the Bo West congregation, relates, "One sister told me, 'If I hear that we will receive a new kingdom hall, I will clap with my hands and feet.' When I announced that we were getting a new hall, the sister leaped from her seat, applauding and dancing, clapping with her hands and feet." In 2010, the Waterloo congregation dedicated a new kingdom hall that can be expanded into an 800-seat assembly hall. The day the congregation purchased the property, the owner received a higher offer from another bidder. She said, "I would rather have a religious conference center on my land than to have it used for commercial purposes." Under the Program for Lands with Limited Resources, 17 kingdom halls have been constructed in Sierra Leone and 6 in Guinea. These modest but dignified places of worship have encouraged many more people to attend meetings. Finding Jehovah's Lost Sheep. As the preaching work gained momentum, the branch office arranged a 2-month campaign to preach in seldom worked territory. Publishers placed nearly 15,000 books and enjoyed many fine experiences. Some people asked if Jehovah's Witnesses would set up congregations in any of the local towns. As a result, 2 new congregations were eventually established. In one remote village, the brothers found 2 displaced sisters who had been cut off from the organization during the war. The brothers immediately organized regular meetings and started several Bible studies in the village. In 2009, the branch office heard of a village deep in the Guinea forest where people claimed to be Jehovah's Witnesses. Sending brothers to investigate, the branch learned that an elderly brother had returned to his native village after he retired. He studied with several men before he died. One of the men put faith in Jehovah and began sharing his Bible knowledge with others. He also held meetings using the deceased brother's publications. The group had been worshiping Jehovah for 20 years before a publisher stumbled across them. The branch immediately sent brothers to assist the group spiritually. In 2012, 172 people in the village attended the memorial of Christ's death. In recent times, a growing number of lost sheep have been found. These are persons who had drifted away or had been removed from the congregation. Many such prodigals have turned around and made their way back to the truth. Jehovah's people have welcomed them with open arms. Sincere Muslims accept the truth. When sharing the good news with others, the Apostle Paul became all things to people of all sorts, 1 Corinthians 9:22-23. Likewise, Jehovah's servants in Sierra Leone and Guinea have adjusted their approach in order to appeal to different people. Consider, for example, how some publishers reason with tolerant Muslims, the largest religious group in both countries. Saidu Juana, who is a former Muslim, explains, "Muslims believe that Adam was created from dust, but that he first lived in a heavenly paradise. To help them grasp the correct understanding, I ask them, 'Where does dust come from?' 'The earth,' they reply. 'So Adam must have been created where?' I continue. 'On the earth,' they answer. To drive home the point, I read Genesis 1:27-28 and ask, 'Do heavenly beings have children?' 'No. Angels are neither male nor female,' they reply. 'When God told Adam and Eve to have children, they must have been where?' I reason. 'On the earth,' they respond. 'So when God restores paradise, where must that paradise be?' I ask. 'Here on earth,' they reply." Saidu concludes, "Such scriptural reasoning prompts many sincere Muslims to listen further and to accept Bible literature." Consider Mama, a Muslim shopkeeper who hoped to become an imam one day. When witness missionaries reasoned with him from the scriptures, Mama became curious. He attended part of a circuit assembly and liked what he heard. 4 days later, he and his wife, Ramatu, and their 5 children attended the memorial of Jesus' death. Mama then started studying the Bible in earnest. After several studies, he stopped selling cigarettes. He told his customers that cigarettes harm people and are disapproved by God. He also started studying with his wife and children at his shop. When customers called during the family study, he asked them to sit and wait, explaining that the study was very important for his family. When he and Ramatu legalized their marriage, their families began bitterly opposing them. Undeterred, Mama and Ramatu boldly witnessed to their relatives, who eventually came to respect their fine conduct. Mama was baptized in 2008 and Ramatu in 2011. Upholding the sanctity of blood. Jehovah's people courageously uphold God's moral standards, including his view of blood. This stand has gained the respect of a growing number of medical professionals in Sierra Leone and Guinea. In 1978, brothers distributed the booklet Jehovah's Witnesses and the Question of Blood to doctors, nurses, hospital administrators, lawyers, and judges throughout Sierra Leone. Soon afterward, a sister who was in labor began bleeding internally, but doctors refused to treat her without blood. One doctor, however, agreed to help because of the informative and logical material that he had read in the blood booklet. The sister gave birth to a healthy baby boy and made a complete recovery. About 1991, Dr. Bashiru Kurama, a surgeon at Kenema Hospital, read the brochure, "How Can Blood Save Your Life?" Impressed by its contents, he began studying the Bible and attending Christian meetings. When a 9-year-old witness boy ruptured his spleen in an accident, the boy's doctors refused to operate without blood. They told his parents, "Take your child home to die." The parents approached Dr. Kurama, who successfully performed the operation. Dr. Kurama soon became Brother Kurama, a staunch defender of bloodless medicine. Other doctors ostracized him for his stand, yet his patients consistently did well. Later, some of his colleagues began seeking his assistance with difficult surgical procedures. Since 1994, the Hospital Information Desk at the branch in Freetown has set up hospital liaison committees in Sierra Leone and in Guinea. These committees have lovingly supported many sick witnesses and persuaded dozens of medical professionals to accommodate our stand on blood. Helping the deaf. According to one estimate, some 3,000 to 5,000 people in Sierra Leone and hundreds of people in Guinea are deaf. Since Jehovah's will is that all sorts of people should be saved, how would the deaf hear the good news? 1 Timothy 2:4. Michelle Washington, a Gilead missionary who arrived in Sierra Leone in 1998, relates, "My husband Kevin and I were assigned to a congregation where four deaf people were attending meetings. Since I could communicate in American Sign Language, I wanted to help them. The branch office invited me to interpret for the deaf at meetings and assemblies and informed nearby congregations of this provision. The branch also sponsored sign language classes for publishers interested in helping the deaf. We began searching out deaf people in the community and conducting Bible studies with them. Seeing our efforts to help the deaf, many people in the community praised us. However, not everyone was pleased with our activity. A pastor ministering to the deaf declared us to be false prophets. He warned the people and their families to stay away from us. Some were told that if they associated with us, their financial aid would be cut off. The deaf community quickly split into two camps: those who had not met us and supported the pastor, and those who had met us and did not support the pastor. Some of the latter group took their stand for the truth and progressed to baptism. Femi, for example, was born deaf and could communicate only by using basic gestures. He was suspicious of everyone, especially hearing people, and felt unhappy and unloved. Then he began studying the Bible with brothers from the sign language group. Soon he was regularly attending Christian meetings and learning sign language himself. Femi progressed to baptism and now happily teaches other deaf people the truth. In July 2010, the Freetown American Sign Language Group became a congregation. There are also sign language groups in Bo and Conakry. Poor but rich in faith. The Bible reveals that most first century Christians were materially poor. The disciple James wrote, "Did not God choose those who are poor from the world's standpoint to be rich in faith?" James 2:5. Faith in Jehovah has also brought comfort and hope to the publishers in Sierra Leone and Guinea. Faith prompts many poor witness families in remote areas to save for months to attend district conventions. Some grow crops to finance their trip. Groups of 20 to 30 delegates cram into small trucks for hot, dusty, bone-rattling journeys that can last 20 hours or more. Other delegates walk long distances. We walked the first 50 miles to the convention, taking along a large supply of bananas, says one brother. We sold the bananas along the way, lightening our load and raising enough money to travel the rest of the way by truck. Faith has also moved many publishers to resist the temptation to move to more materially prosperous lands. "We trust that Jehovah will care for our needs," says Emmanuel Patton, a graduate of the Bible School for Single Brothers. "Because we live in a land where the need for kingdom preachers is great, we realize that our service is especially valuable." Emmanuel now serves as a congregation elder, and both he and his wife, Eunice, work tirelessly to promote kingdom interests. Other family heads choose not to move in order to protect the unity and spirituality of their families. I refused to accept work that would take me away from my family for extended periods of time, says Timothy Niu Ma, who served as a special pioneer and substitute circuit overseer. My wife Florence and I also educated our children locally rather than sending them away to be raised by others. Other brothers and sisters display faith by persevering in Christian activities despite various difficulties. Kevin Washington, mentioned earlier, observes, "Many publishers regularly preach and care for congregation responsibilities in the face of problems that might prompt us to stay home and be cranky. Some, for example, are chronically ill and do not have access to the medical care and remedies that are readily available elsewhere. Others make great efforts to become literate. If I am ever critical about the way a brother handles an assignment, I ask myself, if I worked full-time, had major health problems, had poor eyesight without corrective glasses, and had a limited theocratic library and no electricity, would I have done as well?" In these and countless other ways, the brothers and sisters in Sierra Leone and Guinea glorify Jehovah. Like their first-century Christian counterparts, they recommend themselves as God's ministers by the endurance of much, by tribulations, by times of need, as poor but making many rich, as having nothing and yet possessing all things. 2 Corinthians 6:4-10. Facing the future with confidence. Over 90 years ago, Alfred Joseph and Leonard Blackman reported that Sierra Leone's fields were white for harvesting. John 4:35. Some 35 years later, Manuel Diogo wrote from Guinea saying, "There is plenty of interest here. Today, Jehovah's servants in both countries are convinced that many more people will yet respond to the good news." In 2012, Guinea had a memorial attendance of 3,479, over 4.5 times the total publishers in the country. The 2,030 publishers in Sierra Leone had 7,854 people attend the memorial, nearly 4 times the number of publishers. One old-timer present on the night of that memorial was 93-year-old special pioneer Winifred Remy. She and her husband Litchfield arrived in Sierra Leone in 1963. After 60 years in full-time service, she was still serving as a special pioneer. Winifred stated, "Who would have dreamed that Sierra Leone would be so rich with strong spiritual brothers and sisters? Although I am old, I still want to share in this joyful increase." The footnote reads, "Winifred Remy died while this account was being prepared." End of footnote. Jehovah's Witnesses in Sierra Leone and Guinea heartily echo Winifred's sentiments. Like stately, well-watered trees, they are determined to keep bearing fruit to Jehovah's praise. In Jehovah's strength, they will keep on proclaiming mankind's real hope of freedom, the glorious freedom of the children of God. Romans 8:21. Determined to serve Jehovah. Philip Tangbe, born 1966, baptized 1997. Profile: a refugee who helped to build 5 kingdom halls.
In 1991, my wife Sutta and I fled for our lives as rebel soldiers overran our hometown, Koindu, Sierra Leone. Over the next 8 years, we lived in many different refugee camps. There we endured food shortages and sicknesses and were surrounded by the immoral activities of our camp neighbors. In each camp, we asked the authorities for land to build a kingdom hall. Sometimes our request was granted and sometimes it was not. Nevertheless, we always arranged to have a meeting place for worship. We were determined to serve Jehovah. Eventually, we built 4 kingdom halls in the camps. When the war ended, we could not return home. Years of fighting had turned Koindu into a wasteland, so we were sent to yet another refugee camp near Bo. There, with funds supplied by the branch office, we built our fifth Kingdom Hall.
I fell in love with Sierra Leone. Cindy McIntyre, born 1960, baptized 1974. Profile: missionary since 1992. She served in Guinea and Senegal and is currently serving in Sierra Leone.
When I first arrived, it took me all of 2 weeks to fall in love with Sierra Leone. I marveled at how people bore heavy loads on their heads with effortless poise. Neighborhoods teemed with life. Children played and danced in the streets, clapping their hands and stamping their feet in lively rhythms. I was surrounded by color, motion, and music. What I enjoy most is preaching here. Sierra Leoneans take pride in welcoming strangers. They respect the Bible and listen to its message. They often invite me into their homes. When I leave, some walk with me all the way down the street. These endearing traits help me to cope with minor discomforts such as water shortages and power outages. Because I am single, people sometimes ask me if I ever feel lonely. Actually, I have so much to do that I haven't had time to get lonely. I lead a life full of purpose.
Years ago, 1914. We believe that the year 1914 gives evidence of greater possibilities of service for the truth than has any previous year of the harvest, stated the Watchtower of January 1, 1914. The year that the Bible students had been anticipating for decades had finally arrived, and they were hard at work in the ministry. As a result of the efforts of the Bible students that year, millions of people heard about the Bible's promises. The world around them, though, expended its efforts in a very different direction. The world becomes more violent. Early in 1914, one of the most violent events in the history of labor strikes in the United States took the lives of men, women, and children. Miners on strike and their families had been evicted from their company-owned housing and were forced to live in tent colonies. On April 20th, in the tent colony near Ludlow, Colorado, shooting erupted. The miners' tent colony was set ablaze. Throughout the region, incensed miners retaliated by killing many company guards. The army was called in to restore order. In Europe, things were much worse. On June 28th, when Gavrilo Princip, a 19-year-old Bosnian Serb, fired the shot that killed Archduke Francis Ferdinand of Austria, he provided the spark that ignited World War I. By year's end, World War I, then known as the Great War, had enveloped Europe. Conventions focus on the preaching work. Amid the world's increasing turmoil, the Bible students encouraged one another to be diligent in the preaching work. The first convention of God's people ever held in South Africa began on April 10th. The peak attendance at that convention was 34. "We were a very little flock indeed," wrote William W. Johnston. "We immersed almost half of those who attended the convention. 8 sisters and 8 brothers symbolized their consecration in the Lord's appointed manner." On the last day of the convention, those assembled talked about how best to advance the preaching work in South Africa. Today, more than 90,000 faithful publishers in South Africa testify to the success of that little flock. On June 28, 1914, the very day that Archduke Ferdinand was shot, the Bible students assembled in Clinton, Iowa, USA. At that convention on June 30th, A.H. McMillan said, "If we wish to receive our reward, we want to keep actively engaged in doing the will of God, out in the service whenever possible, carrying the harvest message to the world."
The photodrama attracts millions. The photodrama of creation, a production consisting of recorded Bible talks and music that were synchronized with colored glass slides and motion pictures, premiered in New York City on January 11, 1914. 5,000 attended that first showing, and many were turned away because of a lack of space. Preparation of the photodrama of creation had taken 2 years, yet it was barely ready to give its first exhibition in January, observed the Watchtower. During the first half of 1914, the brothers made several improvements to the photodrama. For example, they added an introductory film with synchronized narration by Charles Taze Russell, making the presentation's sponsorship clear. At its peak, the photodrama played simultaneously in as many as 80 cities. By July of 1914, it had reached Great Britain, being shown to packed houses in Glasgow and London. September saw the production reach Denmark, Finland, Germany, Sweden, and Switzerland. By October, it had reached Australia and New Zealand. In all, over 9 million people saw the photodrama in its first year. Each copy of the photodrama consisted of hundreds of glass slides, many reels of motion picture film, and dozens of records. The copies were expensive to produce, and each showing required an experienced crew of brothers and sisters. Thus, the complete photodrama was primarily shown in large cities. In order to reach those in rural areas, the Bible students also produced 3 abbreviated versions of the photodrama. One version, known as the Eureka Drama Y, contained tinted glass slides that were accompanied by recorded Bible talks and music. The other versions, known as the Eureka Drama X and the much shorter Eureka Family Drama, were audio only, with no slides or motion pictures. In the United States, more than 70,000 people had seen a version of the Eureka drama by the end of 1914, less than 4 months after it was released. Colporteurs and volunteers share in the preaching work. While the photodrama work was new and exciting, the Bible students recognized that other forms of the preaching work were their first priority. A letter from Charles Taze Russell to all colporteurs, now called pioneers, stated, "We know of no branch of the service yielding larger fruitage in this harvest time. For this reason, we are discouraging colporteurs from entering the photodrama work. Other brothers and sisters, equally loyal to the Lord, can serve in the drama work." In January of 1914, the number of colporteurs was 850. Over the course of the year, those zealous evangelizers distributed more than 700,000 copies of Studies in the Scriptures. The Watchtower expressed a warm interest in the colporteurs and encouraged its readers to speak to them words of encouragement, for their way is not always strewn with thornless flowers. Other Bible students distributed tracts in dozens of languages. During 1914, they placed over 47 million copies of the Bible Students Monthly and other tracts. The Bible students' work did not go unnoticed. Their preaching was public, and their meetings were free. One of Christendom's ministers lamented, "By and by, people will think it is a crime to take up a collection, and then where shall we be? Pastor Russell is bringing us all into disrepute." The end of the Gentile times. The Bible students believed that the times of the Gentiles, spoken of in Luke 21:24, King James Version, would end about October 1, 1914. As October drew near, anticipation increased. Some Bible students even carried a countdown card so that they could mark off each passing day. Many felt that they would be called beyond the veil or to heaven on that date. On the morning of October 2, 1914, Brother Russell entered the Bethel dining room and announced to the Bethel family, "The Gentile times have ended. Their kings have had their day." Some of those present would have recognized those words, which were based on Song 171 in their songbook, Hymns of the Millennial Dawn. Since 1879, the Bible students had been singing, "The Gentile times are closing." But those words were no longer true, since the Gentile times, or the appointed times of the nations, had indeed ended. Luke 21:24. In time, our songbooks reflected this important change. By year's end, the Messianic kingdom had been firmly established in the heavens, and some Bible students thought that their work was done. Little did they know that they were about to enter a period of testing and sifting. The year text for 1915 was, "Are ye able to drink of my cup?" based on Matthew 20:22 in the King James Version. The cup Jesus was referring to included the trials that he would face up until his death. The Bible students were about to face trials, both from within and from outside their ranks. Their response to those trials would prove their loyalty to Jehovah.